This week's episode of the FitCast is brought to you by BlackStarLabs.com, one of the best-tasting protein powder out there and a great branched-chain amino acid supplement called ICE. You can check them out at BlackStarLabs.com. Don't forget to mention the FitCast when you place your order. Again, this week's episode features music by Jail titled Everyone's Hip. You can check them out at SubPop.com. Episode of the FitCast. This is episode number 179. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and along with me this week is my companion and co-host, Dr. Jonathan Fass.
Companion.
Hi, Kevin.
How are we doing, John?
Did John become a cocker spaniel?
Something like that. And then we have my sidekick who did not allow me to come over for the sleepover last night, Lee Peel. What's up, Lee? From LeePeel.com.
I'm sorry about that.
What's up with that, Lee? I couldn't sleep.
I didn't even know. That's what it really was about. I didn't even know. I wasn't even aware. I would have said yes.
All right. Well, anyways.
So there you go.
We have a great show lined up for you this week. Of course, as we mentioned last week, we have an interview with Dr. John Browdy that's going to be coming up. We talk about quite a few things, including fasting and lots of other topics, and John's always a great interview. It's quite lengthy. It's about an hour. So as you probably notice from looking at your iPod, your computer, whatever, this is about a two-hour episode, and I'm just going to guesstimate because we haven't recorded it yet, but it's probably going to come in about that long. But, yeah. Next, I want to quickly mention, I just ordered some more T-shirts. So right now we have women's sizes in small and medium in white. We have men's in medium, in large, and gray. We also have men's in medium, large, XL, and XXL. So if you're interested in getting some t-shirts, you can head over to thefitcast.com. There's a page there on how to pick them up. And again, please, you can help support the podcast. You can get a pretty cool shirt at the same time by doing that. We've been mailing everything priority, so they've been getting to people pretty quickly. And I thank you to everyone that's ordered them so far. And again, guys, check them out. They're really cool shirts. You can see a video of Tony Jellicoe wearing them on KevinLarrabee.com. He's sporting the black tee if you want to see what it looks like. And you can see him doing a little dance after George Abel does a trap bar deadlift, which is kind of cool. So check that out. He looks like a stud in the t-shirt. It's it adds about 20 pounds of muscle to you when you wear it. Yeah, except for the women's, which makes you look like Jessica Alba, which is cool, or Beale, whatever. Man, I shouldn't have had that spike. So I want to quickly also mention that I'm putting together some training videos for you guys. So if you have any ideas of videos that you'd like to see, you can please just send them to me through Facebook, Twitter. You can go to questions@thefitcast.com and send them that way, or kevin@thefitcast.com. And let me know if there's any training videos that you would like me to shoot for you guys. Just let me know. And always open to some ideas. And I hope to have some reviews for Eric Cressy's and Mike Reinhold's shoulder DVD series from that one-day seminar that they put together. I'm hoping to get through a lot of that today, but we talked about an hour before we recorded the podcast, so I don't know how much we'll get through that. And also, Mike Robertson has a new DVD set out called Single Leg Solution, which you can pick up now through RobertsonTrainingSystems.com, which I've been looking through the manual so far, and it looks awesome. And the reviews so far from other people have been fantastic, so I really recommend checking that out. And I hope to have Mike on the podcast next week to talk about it as well, because single leg training is something that we all know we should do, but a lot of people might be very wary about how to build up to doing single-legged squats and how to build up single-legged strength and not just jumping right in and doing rear-foot elevated split squats or Bulgarian split squats. So it's a DVD series that I think you might really want to keep an eye out for. And last but not least, I'm going to do a quick call-out for people out there. If you enjoy the podcast, if you enjoy what you're listening to, please tell other people about it. I know a lot of people out there have Twitter accounts, you have Facebook. You don't understand how much it would mean to us if you just post a quick link on your Facebook profile or Facebook update or a Twitter update or even on your blog, just telling people a little bit about the podcast, maybe posting a link to one of your favorite episodes and having them check it out. I know a lot of people linked to the Todd Durkin interview last week. It seemed to be very popular, so maybe that would be a good one to do. So again, always please try to spread the word, and we appreciate it very much when you do so. But you guys, how about some voicemails?
Voicemails.
That would be great.
You guys should, you know, you can always call up our voicemail line at 978-633-3488 and leave a voicemail for us. Or if you want to use the cooler phone number, it's 775-45-FITCAST or FITCA. Because you can't, there's, okay. So the first one that we're going to get to is about NO supplements. So let's listen to that one.
FITCAST, what's up? This is Mark from Salt Lake City, Utah. What up, Lee? Hey, guys. I have a question about NO supplements. I think it's nitric oxide. My brother-in-law is sold on it, and I just was wondering what your guys' opinion on those kind of supplements are. Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
So, NO supplements. I think it's something we've talked a little bit about in the past, but it's always good to reiterate and, you know, talk about things that maybe some of our new listeners haven't heard about. So let's talk a little bit about it. First, the most popular one's probably No Explode. A very interesting product that has about 48 ingredients on the bottle. I'm not joking, John.
Yeah, no, it does. It's a laundry list of crap. Yeah,
it's got about three active ingredients, which would probably be the creatine, the caffeine, and the arginine. But Lee, could you talk about a little bit more NO supplements, you know, worth the money, you know, should he check them out? Maybe there's some alternatives.
I think that there's some things that would require a long rant, but this is not one of them. Don't waste your money. What usually people buy it for is to get a pump or to get a little bit more energy. You know, basically they buy it for vascularity. And it's just, you'd be much better off saving your money and in investing in some creatine and just a good, you know, post pre-workout nutrition setup. And it's as simple as that. There's absolutely nothing to support spending that kind of money on a supplement with that big of a laundry list of ingredients that for the most part have no study support behind them whatsoever. And I mean, not to give direction towards the caller, just to say that it's one of those things that it's not even worth wasting your time on. It's just, there's 1,001 supplements out there that are bull, and it's just, in my opinion, one of them.
So definitely just stick with the creatine kind of thing.
Yeah, you're gonna save more money. Save more money.
About people that supplement with arginine? Because you know the whole story out there, and maybe I don't want to get into the research too much, but you know the vascularity is going to help keep your muscles fueled better and get more nutrients to the muscles, et cetera, et cetera. You know, BS or not?
I mean, it's just you eat food.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Cool. Orally, do you remember? Like orally, you can take the arginine, but it's like massive doses to see any kind of effect, which isn't. And then see, the problem is also like these kinds of questions is that, okay, so the brother-in-law is sold. Now, what is it? I mean, we don't really know why he sold, like what kind of benefit he thinks he's getting from it. Physiologically, we know that it does not work, but there's placebo effect. So people take these things. That's why these things continue to be marketed and get good results, because let's say 10% of the people see effect, or 20% of the people, whatever. I mean, when they do studies on medicine, it's somewhere, I wish I could remember the numbers, but I think it's somewhere like 20-30% are placebo. I mean, and this, the old saying is 50% of all medicine is placebo. So, you know, you can't say that these things don't work. They just don't work because they don't work physiologically by the reasoning that they provide. We know that's a fact.
Good point.
But it may still work, and it's hard. Like, I'm completely with Lee saying don't waste your time and money. But if he thinks he's getting a benefit, good luck to tell him he's not. I mean, I think that's the big problem with a lot of these products, and I think that's the big problem in general with the way that our fitness industry and especially the supplement industry is marketed, because there will always be people that get results. If I told you to go out, there's new research on eating grass, go out in the front lawn, eat grass, and you're going to lose weight, I guarantee you there's going to be people that it actually works for. And then they're going to go out and say, I lived on John Fass's grass diet and I lost 20 pounds. And then there's going to be a rush of people to try to do it because they think it's the next big thing. It doesn't work, but there will always be people that it works for. And that's the problem with kind of like these word of mouth anecdotal result stories. So you always have to be careful with that. You can present someone with the literature. You can present someone with the research and say this doesn't work. But if they perceive a benefit, it's their money to waste. And then the argument is, are they even wasting it because they think that they're getting a benefit from it? As long as there's nothing dangerous about it and I can't prove – actually, well, correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't there some like – question on the
I actually think there was safety? Some question towards the safety.
Yeah, I think yeah. There was. So if that's the case, then I would definitely say don't take it, because I think that we're all kind of remembering a few questionable, you know, side effect situation things. But, you know, if someone goes out and eats grass before they work out and they swear it's the best workouts of their lives, I'll tell you you're wasting time, but I can't tell you not to do it. But with NO supplements, there seems to be enough question that maybe it's not a great idea regardless.
Cool.
Good point.
Okay, let's go to the next voicemail that we got about the Vibram five-finger shoes.
Hi, good morning, afternoon. This is Tina. I'm calling from New Jersey. You guys are doing a great job. Anyway, I wanted to submit a question. I found out about these shoes. They're called five-finger shoes. And they fit your feet like gloves, and they're supposed to be good for indoor and outdoor training, running, hiking, etc. And I was wondering if you guys heard anything about it, and if they are definitely worth the $75 investment. And they're called Five Finger Shoes. And thanks a bunch. Hope you can help. Bye.
All right, to be completely fair, that's from like 3 months ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we talked about it last week, right? Or the week before?
We did talk about them a couple weeks ago. Yeah. But let's put it this way. I just bought a new pair of Nike Freeze. So, I do still like them. But the only reason I put it in there is just to give people a quick update. Dude, I'm telling you, I wash those things every week. And after like 2 or 3 days of wearing them, like when you take them off your feet smell. Like it's like it's like complete like foot sweat smell, and I'm like,
yeah,
and you know, it's the idea of them is cool as all. Like I would, but also it's just a problem with the design. Like your feet sweat like crazy, and I'm not being modest or anything. My feet never smell. Like I have pretty awesome feet, and I don't have like. You know, you take off my shoes and my feet smell. So it's definitely a thing of the Vibrams. And, you know, it stinks like when you take, like literally, when you take off your Vibrams, your whole bedroom is going to smell like feet for like half an hour until you shower or until you put the Vibrams somewhere else. So, I still like Nike Freeze. I still think they're good cross-training shoes, but I also like the Vibrams. I think they definitely have a place, and if you can deal with that fact, then by all means, they are pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go to the next voicemail that we have that is about training abs daily.
You know what? I'm sorry. Hold on 1 second. You know what I was just thinking about is, and this will sound a little, you know, I don't know, questionable, but follow me. You know, they make girls wear them all the time, those like socks that are cut out like toes or something like that.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could use them.
Well, the only reason why I've gotten – oh, you mean in the Vibrams? Yeah, I know. Someone mentioned that they
– And they actually have socks too for them.
Yeah, they do. Someone was at a powerlifting meet and someone wore the Vibrams and they force you to wear socks because when you deadlift, they don't want you bleeding all over the bar. So the – yeah, they actually do make socks for them, so they just wore those.
Yeah.
But – sorry, homie, don't play that game. I'm supposed to wear them because they're called barefoot and I'm not going to wear socks.
Dude.
Hey, dude, guess what?
Next voicemail.
Hi, Kevin. I'm wondering if you think that ads can be worked every day, and if so, why don't they need recovery time like other muscles? Thanks.
So, guys, training abs daily. I think it's a very cool subject. Do you think a lot of people kind of get their start? I've had people come into the gym when I worked in a commercial gym and be like, oh yeah, you know, I wake up every day and the first thing I do in the morning is I do 50 sit-ups and I do 50 push-ups and, you know, then I go on with my day. And I think a lot of people when they go to the gym, and I don't want to say it's necessarily a thing that's just for women, but you see them many times, they always do abs and they always do some kind of adduction. What do you guys think? Training abs every day, is that okay? Is it too much? And I guess, you know, do you want to get into the whole discussion of, you know, training an anti-rotation component and then maybe training a flexion component and splitting that up and things like that. So, John, what do you think?
I guess it really – you can train any muscle every day. It's a matter of the intensity and the volume of doing it. And most of us aren't going to train that way because it's kind of like, why are you bothering? But if you think about it, any physical laborer trains his muscles or her muscles every day, but they do so to the extent this is basically their limit. You know, so if I'm a construction worker and I just started working, then I'm probably going to be sore, you know, after I've been using the jackhammer or something, you know, whatever. But after a period of time, I'm no longer sore because my body is adapted to that. It's the same kind of concept as running, you know, steady running. If I don't increase my intensity or I don't increase my volume, I'm basically just maintaining. So the same thing happens to any muscle in the body. If I'm just doing a workout that maintains, then I can do it every day because I'm really not causing enough physiological stress and breakdown and recovery cycles that I need to actually take that time off. When you look at it always becomes a question about the abs, because the abs are a little bit unique in where they are in the body. They are designed specifically for endurance factors more than absolute strength. And if you think about it, when do you actually use your abs for an absolute strength? You can make the arguments of like athletic endeavors like swinging a baseball bat, or, you know, even, you know, throwing a baseball or a football or something where the abs will be used like very quickly at high intensity. But the fact of the matter is, in general, it doesn't quite work out that way, certainly not in day to day. So if I'm training for spine health, for back health, for general health, I can absolutely work them every day as long as I'm doing just that. I'm just training to maintain my strength levels. If I'm training to increase them, which means I'm adding intensity, I'm adding volume, then you really can't, because now you are encouraging muscle breakdown and you need that recovery. So it's kind of like, what's your point? You know, do you want to get stronger abs, or do you want to have, you know, general health, you know, whatever, where you can do a quick set of like planks for a minute or something and that doesn't really cause any stress. So it's kind of, I don't know. I don't know the answer. Yes and no.
That was awesome.
Indeed. Well, hopefully that answers your question. I think it's something that isn't – it depends kind of an answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously it's a depends kind of answer. And I think John hit it on the point too. It's about overload, you know, and – I mean, you know, it's one of those questions that it gets to the point of it. You know, you walk every day. It's leg training. I mean, you know, to a degree, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, there's certain levels in which the kind of base level of adaptation takes place, and it becomes about overload, and it becomes about, you know, assistance. And so, I mean, I think John was like, you know, dead on. So in this way, yes and no. You know, like you technically absolutely can train your abs every day, but you know, we're not talking about throwing, you know, a 100-pound plate and doing, you know, incline sit-ups. It's not, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, neither is John. So it's about the progression of the overload. I think John hit it spot on.
Right. And for the record, I mean, when we look at the research does indicate that training those muscles for endurance and training them daily for endurance activities, hitting a certain, you know, ability, you know, a 3-minute plank, 2-minute side plank, things like that, that are indicated by evidence to be protective of the spine, is what we have in terms of like a an evidence-based training protocol. So from that standpoint, you are okay to work your abs every day. If you've got reached those levels and maintain those levels, there's no evidence to suggest that you need to go further. Most of us don't do that though, and that's fine, because it's kind of like, what's the point of doing it? You know what I mean? Like I want to challenge myself. I want to do different stuff. The way that I address ab routines is that I think that you should be doing the evidence-based activities that we know of, the plank, the side plank, bird dog, and partial curl-ups. Anything else you want to add to it, as long as it hasn't been indicated to be damaging to the spine, you know, full sit-ups or have been indicated to be potentially damaging, you know, stuff like that, then I say go for it. You know what I mean? Because there's no evidence to suggest that it's bad for you. And quite frankly, it's probably enjoyable. It'll increase your overall fitness level and quality, and it'll probably add to your strength, and that's probably a good thing. But I do think that for the sake of health, those are things that you should address as well.
Let's go to the next question about milk and female post-workout nutrition.
Hello, Kevin Larrabee and the FitCast. This is Nollig Wallace calling from...
I want to say the first thing I heard that, I swore it was Tony Genelcore, but it's not.
From Seoul, South Korea. I just had a question about milk. I know that a lot of nutritionists recommend drinking only water and green tea and don't recommend drinking juices and other such drinks. But milk, where does that stand? Some people recommend drinking chocolate milk for post-nutrition work...
My dog is having a nightmare right now. I don't know if you heard that. Riley, come on.
I did hear that.
I heard
that.
The whimper.
Riley.
Yeah.
All right.
Sorry. The quality of the thick cast just dropped.
Well, sorry. He was whining. Hold on. You're going to keep going. I'll back it up a couple of seconds just in case anyone missed it.
Some people recommend drinking chocolate milk for post-workout nutrition. But what about milk? Just plain old milk. Is it good for us, or should we stay away from it? Second question. Can you recommend some sites or some information for post-workout nutrition for women? I know a lot of women who are making great efforts in the gym these days, but then refuse to eat anything afterwards because they don't want to ruin the gains they've made in the gym. But it's to my understanding that after going through a heavy workout in the gym, whether it be weight training or cardio, you need to supplement the body with some type of nutrition. Post-workout nutrition. So can you recommend some sites or give me some hard, concrete information that I can pass on to my friends? Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
So, Lee, I'm going to toss this over to you because you are a female. And you are also, you also are a go-to nutrition expert on the show.
I do have a badge. Okay. We'll see. Let's,
Leah's just off the rails today. I wish you guys, before I call you guys on Skype,
the
just
off topic,
record.
Off topic,
the off, off like the off limit, off topic. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So it's really funny that I just said that, and I'm going to go where I'm going to go. I just think it's ironic. So, first part of the question is, he asked if is milk okay? Is it safe? I'm going to try and condense this because I know that it's we only have so long we're recording, but I do want to touch a little bit on the myths and the somewhat alarmist thoughts behind milk in general and kind of where they come from. There's usually three primary reasons people don't recommend for you to take in milk. I mean, yes, there's other, but I'm going to just hit on kind of the main three. One is lactose intolerance and the claim that people in general, particularly American white born people, are not capable of processing the enzyme lactose that is in milk. That can or cannot be the case, and it's a personal thing. not digesting the milk properly or not having the enzyme function doesn't even technically mean anything bad is going to happen to you. It just means that you don't break something down very well, and it can cause a collection of gas or constipation issues. Does it feel good? It's not fun, but it isn't necessarily, is going to harm you on a very long-term level, at least moderately, to the point to where it could possibly harm you. I don't know why you'd be drinking it, basically, on that level. That's kind of the sign of don't drink it if you're one of those people. There are lactate milks or milk that put a lactose enzyme in there so that you can drink those milks and not have the problem. So there's that issue, and it's just kind of a personal preference. There's the issue of ever since the China study was released, the issue was brought up about a casein in cancer and the relevance that casein has on cancer. A lot of people claim that it causes cancer. And the biggest problem with that is again, we have another one of those issues of where one study or a collection of studies put together were released. In this instance, it's in this book, The China Study, that people take and they kind of run with it, not actually reading the study or even understanding what it's about. Cancer is a very, very complex thing. I don't even begin to know every aspect of it, but it's been something that I've personally researched a lot. So I know the base kind of area of it. But basically, you either have a mutation of the initial mutation of the cell and then the growth of those cells and spreading. Basically, you have the bad, and then how much does the bad spread? That's really oversimplistic way of saying it, but that's what you're basically looking at. Casein does not make the bad. That's not what the study said. The casein doesn't just create the bad. A lot of people think that a bunch of rats were, stuck in a room, and then, he came along, he injected them with pure casein protein, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they started to develop cancer. It doesn't work that way. They were given cancer, and then they were given protein to see what would happen in the growth of cells. All that casein did was just grow cells, not even cancerous cells, which is important to note, but cancerous-like growth in cells with the casein over, I believe it was a soy protein, and I cannot remember what the other protein was. It was another vegetable protein. So those two vegetable proteins did not have the same cancer-like growth as the casein did. That was where it stopped. Nothing else was tested. It wasn't as if he injected beef protein to see what kind of growth that had, or he injected whey protein to see what kind of growth that had, or any other protein that you can think of. He just stopped there. That was it. And from that route, casein was, a cause of cell growth or cancer growth, which technically wasn't even what it was. And there are some big words and a lot of details to that, but that's basically where that was born. That was the study that was born. There have been studies since then. One of the most recent one that I just tagged for the use of the show is from the Department of Food and Nutritional Services, 2010, from the University of Cork, and it found no human cell growth whatsoever was derived from casein. These studies were also done in rats, and rats that were given cancer specifically for the point of the study. So, in not short, there's really not a lot of ground or basis for this. It's one man's book that's kind of spun this into a conversational effect. And if you look at the research and you looked at it collectively, you will definitely see the holes. In fact, some studies like biofunctional peptides from milk proteins and mineral binding effects, you will see positive effects from milk, not negative ones. So my point is you need to look at the collection of studies as a whole, and there's a lot of alarmist theories out there about casein, and it is mainly sourced from the China study and that area. And if you really look into that, you see that there are a lot of flaws there, a lot of flaws. So that's kind of like your second argument that you have against the use of milk. The third is about the hormones. that can be used in certain milk, particularly if it's not raw or if it's released from large companies in big stock pens. If you take out the ethical issues, we're just talking about the pure hormones. What you have to realize is these hormones can only go into the cows through injections. What it means is if you gave the cows a pill, they would not get the benefit of the hormones. Their digestive system would eat through basically the positive effects of those hormones before anything would happen. That's essentially what would happen. So they have to take this in through ejection. Then they have their milk come out. We drink the milk. And if you look at it in a logical sense, you cannot go from the injection phase of what a cow has happened to you to the digestion phase of what we go through. Our digestive system also does that. That is why steroids are injected, that people take for aesthetic qualities or for, you know, other means like that. Even when you go to the doctor and you get a cortisol shot, our digestive systems has a very hard time utilizing that and processing it without destroying it firsthand. So, you know, I think that you're going to find, you know, hormone has just general, milk has just general hormones in it, as do a lot of proteins. So, you know, that is going to, that has some sort of base of hormone in it just on its natural state, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the injected hormone state. There are lots of arguments towards that doing things to people, but it's just simply not founded. And thus far I've yet to see any sort of research that points to that being an issue. There are positive muscle building effects of milk, et cetera, et cetera. I'll try and stop it there. But the main take home point is that most of the things that you're looking at are alarmist things that don't have any sort of backing to them. And you have to really look at the details, because that is truly where the devil or the saint is in this instance. You know, milk isn't for everyone. You don't have to drink it, but, you know, making it some sort of scapegoat for problems, I don't really think is necessary. There's a larger picture that I won't necessarily go to as far as the study goes. As for post-workout nutrition, and the reason I was going to keep this so simple, is it is the same for men as it is for women. The amount is going to be different, obviously, or can be, depending on the activity level for women. You know, men are, you know, train, burn more calories and produce more, you know, just energy expenditure and need more repair. So therefore the amount that they're going to take in is going to be, you know, a little bit less on average than it is, but the same need is there for the carbohydrate, for the protein, and in some cases fat for pre, and post-workout, just depending upon the need. As far as a resource, just to keep it really, really simple, there is an ongoing thread at bodybuilding.com in the forums, that has been started and updated by Alan Argon. It's very informative. It has lots of links to the research and should do well enough to provide the evidence that you need, and is a very just simple free resource that's out there. So tried to wrap that up as quickly as possible.
Bam!
Kevin, where's that explosion? Where's that explosion sound bite? You don't have it registered. You should have been looking that up when she was dropping.
No,
the
John,
knowledge.
It's the only reason I didn't say it is because I wanted to quickly say first. Is that good? Or want to do something like this?
No, I like the ticking.
This is just straight up bomb. This is for John.
Ooh.
Like that?
Yeah, I like that.
There's a whole website just built on, you know, bombs, you know, for...
True story, after my workout today, I had a cup of whole milk and a cup of chocolate milk.
Do you have cancer?
That was my, not that I know of, God forbid. You son of a biatch.
Yeah, you can't joke about that.
What?
You know, and you know what? My dog has cancer, and you know that.
How do I know that?
Because it's on Facebook.
It's on Facebook. I didn't know that. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, she has cancer in her pelvis.
Let's take a quick break on that note, and we're going to go into
the way to bring the whole podcast down, Kevin.
What can I do, John? What can I do to make it up to you?
You can find a cure for my puppy's cancer.
I can't do that, John.
Well, then you're going to have to go to break.
What about like we always do with this time. I go for mine. I got to shine. Now throw your hands up in the sky. Does that make you feel better?
Helps a little.
Huh.
She's really sick, though.
I'm sorry, John.
Sorry, John. Stick around. Be right back. Okay, time for the mailbag. We're going to get through a few quick questions. Again, thank you, everyone, who sent in voicemails. Again, you can send those in to 978-633-3488 or 775-45-FITCAST. So let's go to the first question from Juraj. I think I said that correctly. This is for Lee. Lee, any tips on minimizing swinging when doing pull-ups?
Do them better.
Okay. Let's go to the next question.
No, hold on. Let me give like an actual... I was being funny, Kevin. I'll be short about it. Obviously, if you're swinging in a pull-up, you're trying to get momentum in order to lift yourself up. There is a type of pull-up called kiffing. It's just different. It's not necessarily. I know a lot of people get in arguments and fights about it, and it's not technically a technical pull-up at complete relaxed state. It's just a different movement. If we're talking about just a pull-up, you should go from a relaxed or a quote-unquote dead hang kind of situation into a complete movement and then back down. All of it being as controlled as possible. So if you're doing any swinging, you're trying to give momentum where there is not, and it means that you could be not necessarily benefiting from the movement as much and causing, somewhat overcompensation issues or not utilizing the proper firing technique that exercise should use for the most part. Sure, if it's the last rep, that's one thing, but if it's the whole time, I like to move away from that and try and fire properly as possible. So it may need to be that you add some support to the actual movement in the way of bands or machine assisted, etc. Definitely work on bracing in the core whenever you're doing the movement to keep yourself from swinging as much. If you brace and actually try and fire in the back, versus trying to use your body in a momentum force, you're going to actually fire in the areas and get the most benefit from the workout. So short, I know, but just that little extra bit might help someone. So sorry, I kept it as short as possible. Yeah, whatever.
Good. John, you want to grab the next question?
I don't know. You're totally out of order.
No, actually, we're not. If you go to the outline for episode 179 on the Google Docs,
Oh, there it is. Yeah, it's just too quick. What up, Kev, Dr. and Lee? I have a question for Kevin about his client, Kim. I've been following Kim's progress on the blog, and I was wondering if you could talk about what you have been doing with her for training and nutrition to get her where she's at. And by the way, Kim, if you were listening, you're a kicking butt girl. You are going to make all the women at your wedding so jealous, and there were three O's there. Thanks so much for the podcast. P.S. You guys need to talk about music more. I'm hooked on stars now. Jen.
That's one for us, Lee. That's one for us. We both won that stars, spreading the love. All right, sorry. Anyways, Jen with two N's, good question. I think if people haven't don't know who she's talking about, been posting updates on Kim, who's one of my personal training clients at Mike Boyle Strength and Conditioning, and she has been one of my clients for about more than a year now, and she has a deadline. She has a date that's coming up, obviously, her wedding, so we've been locking things in for her with when it comes to her training and nutrition. Just a little bit of background on her. You can probably tell from her pictures that she didn't have a lot of weight to lose. She had, she wanted to lose about 15 pounds, and she just wanted to I'm not a woman, but I'm guessing this is something that a lot of women want to do.
Back up a second.
John, we're trying to keep the show professional. Remember what we talked about before the show?
Everything now just made sense for me.
Okay.
And it took this long. All right, go for it.
So, anyways, women, when it's their wedding day, it's all about them, and it has to be the one day they look perfect. So again, it's nice. She has a little bit of motivation there as well. So she came up to me. She knew about the accountability blog stuff that we'd done in the past, and she's like, "Yeah, you know what? I went in on that. I want to be able to. I need all the extra motivation that I can get to do this." And the accountability was a big part of it. But so what we really did with Kim is it's not rocket science. She has a certain amount of calories that she can hit every day, certain macronutrient breakdown that she can hit every day. Much of the stuff is adopted from Lee Peel's stuff in Body by Eats, and also if you've checked out her fat loss troubleshoot stuff. And Kim has been doing great with it. She's found it very easy to transition to it, and it's so not cliched, but she comes into the gym, she's smiling every day. She looks fantastic. You can tell she doesn't wear pants to her training session every time now. She wears shorts. She doesn't wear baggy t-shirts and sweatshirts. She wears like tank tops to the gym now. And she just has like so much more confidence when it comes to her physique and her training now. It's actually quite cool. So, Jen, I'm going to be, straightforward. We do very much, we lift heavy, and we go for about an hour, and we do some conditioning at the end, 3 days a week. Two of the days she's with me, one of the days I give her a program to do at Boston Sports Club. And that puts, again, some of the responsibility on her, in her hands as well. But nutrition, it's not rocket science. It's not like I'm not having her drink maple syrup and having nothing but lemon juice every day. It's very simple. It's omelet in the morning. She's able to have lean meats and lean sources of protein throughout the day. She has her vegetables. We limit her artificial sweetener stuff to one drink a day, whether it be in coffee, which she's gone all the way. She drinks her coffee black now, from going from drinking coffee with cream and two Splendas in it. She goes all the way drinking it black. And she's even found herself just leaning on green tea and things like that. And she's been doing great. Her treat every day is her post, her during workout shake, because she leaves school, she drives right to the gym, and she gets, we have like a Metrex protein shake machine where she drinks one of those while she's training, and it's like getting her dessert. It's her reward from the day. And we have scheduled in some refeeds. Well, in the case of where she had her bridal shower, I think it was, and she had French toast at her bridal shower, and it was like a huge deal. It was pretty cool. It's again just having a goal and sticking to it, and sometimes having a deadline is a good thing, and making sure you have the support around you. And she does, with her fiance, and luckily she's not that she's fortunate enough to train with me twice a week, but she has the ability to pay to do personal training twice a week, and kind of have that set in her schedule. She knows she's going to be there on Monday and Wednesday every week at 3 o'clock, and that's something that's easy to stick with. But you can do the same thing with a friend, or with a personal trainer near you. But God, I rambled way too much. I feel like John Fass. Hey, John, by the way, I got a question for you.
Oh, sure.
It's a question from Katie. I've suddenly been getting plantar fasciitis in my left heel. I've been feeling as though I have excessively tight calf muscles in my left leg as well. I've done mobility work, foam rolling, stretching, even rest and ice. All seem to bring mild relief, but as soon as I go for a walk with the dog, I notice the pain in my heel acting up shortly upon returning. It hurts most after getting out of bed in the morning. I strength train regularly with a full body workout and train with kettlebells in between strength days, and always allow one to two full rest days. I've gone through the assessment as per Cressy's Neanderthal No More article series. Upon studying pics of myself and starting to pay attention to walking, squatting, and other biomechanical habits, I seem to have internal rotation of my left femur. Can this lead to problems such as plantar fasciitis? What can I incorporate into my program to correct internal rotation, regardless of whether or not it's the cause of the plantar fasciitis? I know if not corrected, it will give me issues down the line. Thanks, Katie. And John, I don't know if she's talking about she does not have internal rotation or she has excessive internal rotation in that left leg.
Yeah. No, I think she had excessive is what she was talking about. If we assume that it's not a mechanical a structural issue, because people do have differences in it's called antiversion and retroversion of the hip, and that can be actual positioning of the hip that you can't really alter. But if we just assume that she's talking about a muscle weakness, or that a hip seems to be internally rotated, or more to the point, which we typically see is like coming out of the squat when the legs kind of duck in, which is a hip internal rotation. All that is glute strengthening, basically. For the most part, I mean, there's some other muscles that are thrown in there, but it's primarily glute strengthening. Can that lead to plantar fasciitis? Yeah, it can. Because you're basically plantar fasciitis is a stretching and lengthening of the plantar surface of the foot, so the bottom of the foot that has a fascial connection. There's also muscle underneath there. The flexor digitorum brevis is there as well, and that can be irritated. And those muscles, the muscles and or the fascia itself, technically in fasciitis, it would be the fascia, it gets stretched, it's painful, and when you wake up the first thing in the morning, that's the classic sign of a plantar fasciitis. So the traditional kind of method, the first approach is the kind of golf ball underneath the foot, ice massages. You can even use a frozen bottle of water and just roll your foot over it. You also stretch out the calves like crazy, because some of the stretching of the fascia can be related to problems up the chain. So you try to make sure you have enough mobility in the ankle, and a lot of times that comes through with calf tightness. But there are times where you try all these methods and it doesn't work, and then you do have to go for something, you know, maybe a little bit more aggressive, like actual shoe inserts from a podiatrist. And then there are even things like surgeries that can be done. I would first go to a physical therapist and or a podiatrist, actually, and make sure that you're doing everything properly and that you can get rid of this easily. Changes in footwear, recent changes in footwear, can cause problems. So if that's occurred, you may want to take a look at your footwear and see what's happening. Working on the hip external rotation and the strength, I can't guarantee that that's going to solve the plantar fasciitis. But, you know, like she wrote, whether or not it helps or not, it's still something that she can definitely look into, and that'll certainly help to solve other possible problems like hip and back pain and knee issues down the line anyway. So it's worthwhile doing, and that's kind of like the basic stuff that we've talked about, you know, TheraBands around the knees for hip abduction when you're squatting. You can do leg against the wall so you can flex the hip up so that your thigh is parallel to the floor and actually push your hip out against the wall. That's a good isometric way to start the process of learning how to do that out of the hole of the squat. But otherwise, yeah, definitely have someone take a look at it, because if you're doing the massage stuff and it doesn't seem to be working, go through the proper channels to make sure that you don't need anything more invasive. But there are cases where people need to have surgery for these things, so it's not necessarily off the table. So you want to exhaust all your other possibilities first.
Dan from the UK wanted to call me out saying, great show. I love counting how many times you say, you know. Try it. It's great. So
how many times I say, you know.
Well, I think
insulting. It's insulting me. I say it all the damn time. I know I do. Okay. Thanks a lot, Dan. Bollocks to you.
Okay. Oh, that'd be an awesome drinking game if we.
That's what I was saying. We need a fake ass drinking game.
Yeah.
Every time.
Yeah.
Maybe this every time I say actually.
That's yeah, is one. That where I say or something? Is that like appropriate to even suggest?
Suggest drinking?
No, suggest drinking to the fit cast. I mean, it kind of like
if you're of age.
I mean,
yeah, but think
if
about
you're of
it.
Age,
drink
and you're home, safe. What are
yeah, but
do?
I'm
we're
saying
we're
to the
gonna
fit
make
cast,
up protein
like,
shakes.
Put a yeah,
yeah right.
Let's
like
do
I'm saying, like is drinking kind of like oh, we should have a fit cast drinking game. But then doesn't that kind of defeat the purpose of the health that we talk about?
Just one night a week, John.
Moderation.
Just say one night a week.
is also something.
But you know what's going to happen? Then we're going to get the same questions every week because no one's going to remember what they heard in the FitCast because they're all going to be drunk.
Yet we'll always have material.
You remember when you were, I don't know, I was just, honestly, I was born for a second. So, Lee, are you going to do an Ozzy Osbourne impression?
I was getting ready to, yes. But then I realized that I wasn't drunk. And so, no, I'm not going to now.
Or we could just do the Saturday Night Live thing where Chris Farley has the guests on all the time. It's like, you remember in, that was awesome. Sorry. Hey, Lee, I got a question for you. It's from Matt from Round Lake, Illinois. Is it Illinois or Illinois?
A great name of like God. A place. Round Lake.
Is it possible to revoke your
John, freaking... I record the podcast, so.
He's in charge, John. You have to do what he says.
And I also have the admin for the website. Hey crew, I've been helping my fiance with her diet and workout regimen as she attempts to lose some body fat in preparation for our December wedding and for general health, of course. I have her reading and following the programs in the Female Body Breakthrough, and I myself am reading the Fat Loss Troubleshoot to help plan meals as I do most of the cooking. She is about 5'2", and while I don't know her weight, she has always been on the heavy side, but I would describe her as having about average muscle mass for a female. Her mother is also undergoing a medically supervised weight loss routine, and during her evaluation, she was told that she was nearly double the lean body mass of the average female. Not sure where those numbers came from, though. My fiance is following a 3-day-a-week strength program, still in the first phase of Female Body Breakthrough, and supplements this with occasional Zumba classes and lunchtime low-intensity cardio sessions in the fitness center of the resort where she works. I know that, fat loss goals aside, she is concerned about her overall muscularity as well. Is there a safe, healthy way for a female in this situation to intentionally cut down on muscle mass and fat, or should she simply focus on fat loss? Thanks.
I couldn't gather if he was saying that the mother got told that she had nearly double and lean body mass, or if it was her that got told.
I believe it was the mother.
Okay, so he's saying that there's a genetic link, or he's thinking there might be a genetic link to why she may or may not have a lot of muscle mass. So, indeed. I'm not going to say, you know. What I am going to say is when we start training, I don't know what her stats are. So I know she's 5'2". I really wish I knew what her weight was. It would let me know a little bit just how on the heavy side she is. It makes me wonder, being that her mother went in for a weight loss routine because you can't a surgery or maybe not, maybe it's just a medically advised routine. I'm not exactly sure, but anyway, I'd like to know some better stats. Not knowing that, usually women think they have more muscle than they have, and I'm not saying that she is, that either of you are mistaken, but a lot of times what we think of as muscle can be tightness, or it can be just strain on the body, inflammation. There's a lot of reasons that women think that they're having muscle or large amount of muscles, that they're not. Fat on top of that, fat on top of trained bodies looks quote unquote very bulky. It's one of those common problems that women run into, usually until they get lean and can actually remove some of that fat. They don't really know what's under there. So my point is, in the shortest ways I can say this possible, is the last thing that you want to deal with when losing fat is to cut down on anything that could give you a metabolic advantage. In order to atrophy purposefully, you would have to do some things that aren't that healthy, and I wouldn't recommend or think that she would benefit from, given that she obviously still has a lot more fat loss to go, or for anyone in general. That's a very kind of controversial topic that I don't really like to touch on without a very large amount of information prior to. So I think to keep this as simple as possible is you need any sort of metabolic advantage that you can get, and muscle is one of those. And I would say let her lose the weight first, focus on the fat loss first and foremost. And then if when she gets to her goal, there's an issue with excess muscle, I guess cross that bridge when you get there. And I'll just leave it at that. Unless anyone has anything else they want to add.
I don't know. Low volume. Work too, probably lower intensity. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess you that's correct. You could add more endurance work versus higher strength and hypertrophy.
Lots of buys and tries.
Yeah, you could do that.
Lots of buys and tries.
But by definition, fat loss in general is already going to lead you towards more of that towards a state anyway. So yeah, you could definitely just cut back on the actual lifting or that you do, or more towards more endurance work for sure.
What about doing some of that hot yoga? What's that yoga that they do in 110 degree heat? Hot yoga.
Yeah.
We're going to do one more question from the mailbag, and I'm going to give this one to you, John. It's from Troy, and Troy asks, hey, guys, this question is for Jonathan. I'm a second-year kinesiology student and want to go into physical therapy. I was wondering if you could recommend a few good physical therapy books, perhaps a few that really influenced how you practice. Any advice would be great. Thanks. That's from Troy.
Anyway, yeah, it's a good question. Good luck in your studies. That's pretty cool. I guess I'll break it up. First of all, honestly, just take a look at Cressy's list. There's a ton of books that he has on his website there that are really good, a lot of them. And you can always browse through that list. That's it's a really comprehensive list. My own personal, my kind of go-to for orthopedic stuff is McGee's orthopedic physical assessment. The muscles testing and function with Florence Kendall is just the standard of physical assessment for muscle testing. Anything else? Some joint manipulation books, but until you're actually, you can't really read that kind of stuff. You have to be trained how to manipulate. Otherwise, had the list somewhere and then I totally lost it. But there's some kines books, and if you're a kinesiology student, I don't know if you really feel like reading them, but I tend to go to let me find it. I'm totally ruining everything because I had it written down and I don't know what I did with it. Well, whatever.
Could you do it as a blog post too, John?
Yeah, I guess I kind of could. The other stuff that I like, I mean, that's kind of like the more evidence-based stuff. That's more of the stuff that you're not going to go wrong with. Other things that you can look at, obviously, testing, what's it called, movement dysfunction. Shirley Saarman is still one of the great, great, great techs in clinical assessments. And I guess it's a little bit more controversial just because objectively it's more difficult to identify. But it is a great way to kind of get a feel for how mechanically people can go wrong and what may occur because of that. Along the same lines, Anatomy Trains by Thomas Myers is a great book. Just not so much in terms of, okay, I can prove this, I can prove that, but it does give you a kind of lead for when things aren't going right. And I think in general, the way that I probably practice at this point is you try to find all the objective things that are wrong. You try to put together a puzzle. If you're treating and the treatment isn't going as you think that it should, the patient isn't getting better as quickly as they should, that's when you start to branch out a little bit and to use more of those types of, non-evidence but more clinically derived methods of looking at things. So in other words, what I use, the quote-unquote Thomas Myers approach, the Anatomy Train approach, first and foremost? No, I probably wouldn't. But if I'm not getting the results that I think that I should be, then I would definitely start to look more there. Or I may add that in on top of the things that I think that should be more evidence-based and should be working anyway. So if that's helpful, I think that there's a line between the evidence-based stuff and the more clinically derived expert opinion stuff. And right now, and I think we've talked about it enough, it's the same in physical therapy as it is in exercise. We have a lot of evidence for things, but we don't really have such a pool of evidence that I think that we can practice, you know, 90% of the time just using evidence-based stuff. And that's just – that's because we just don't have enough of it at this point, not because it doesn't work, but because it's just not enough to really give you all of the answers that you need all of the time. So I think as you go through your studies, pay attention to the evidence. It's what drives us, what leads our profession. But get involved in other other things that are out there. Don't take them as the law, because I think that's where people also have problems. They think, oh, this answers all my questions, and they just practice by guru, which isn't always the best thing. But be aware of those things and bring them into your own studies, into your own methodologies, to know that they're there and to have that in your cookbook. So hope that helps, and good luck.
Absolutely.
Nice.
Look forward to getting some more questions down the road for Dr. Fass from you.
Thanks. Well, actually, that's true. Yeah. Ask away. I get concerned for anyone asking me questions. God help them.
That's not going to help us at all, John.
Hey, man, I'm just calling it like I see it. I can't even tell you where I am. I mean, come on.
Oh, your humbleness.
Okay, can we actually tell him?
Great quality.
Can we tell him, John?
No, we can't.
No.
We can't.
You're on a space station, John.
That's true.
That's why there's that lag. If you can tell there's lag between John, it's because it has to bounce off the satellites. He's on Mir 2, the sequel to Mir 1.
Oh, Newman. Donald Newman is the kinesiology book that I like.
Have you ever read the Travel and Simmons, the two volumes of the Myofascial Pain and Dysfunction, John?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really – actually, that's a great
– that was one that I was just – you know, I didn't want to – but that's – when you were talking about things that are not so much more clinical based, or, you know, mm-hmm. where there's not a lot of evidence. But I thought if you're going to look into that at all, you know, that's a set that I like.
Yeah, that's a great, 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 great book. Books, yeah. It's expensive though too.
I'm not even going to pretend like I've read every word of it. Just saying. It's
no, I've no, you freeze to it. No, those are one of those books that sits on the desk.
Yeah.
The patient comes in, and you're going, taking the history. And you're going, what the hell is going on here? And you run back, and you look at the book, and you're like, oh, it's your lat trigger point. Yeah, absolutely. And then you look like a genius. yeah, no, that's a great call too. Those are excellent, excellent books. But yeah, I mean, and that's a good example. I mean, it's evidence based in the sense that it's a combination of like a life's work, you know. But it's not. I'm not sure how much they've looked into it, Travell's books, and actually verified these things. But they're kind of like a standard practice sort of thing for trigger point therapy. So those are great books. Absolutely indispensable.
Cool. Well, we're going to wrap up this week's episode. All I'm going to do is ask you to check us out on iTunes. You can submit reviews through there. Please, and also, you know, if iTunes is too much, you know, you don't want to go through that hassle, you don't have an iPod, we're also on the Zune Marketplace. For those of you out there, all three of you that have Zunes, which, you know, I think is very unfortunate, because I think it's a great device. If you are on Windows, if I was on Windows, I would own a Zune and not an iPod, I'll put it that way. So you can check us out on there. You can also listen to the podcast just right from the website at thefitcast.com. We have a little player there on the right side. You can check that out. And check out leaphill.com. Check out... John doesn't do anything. Check out leaphill.com.
No.
And we have tons of cool stuff coming up next week. Next week, who is our guest? I think it's John Romanello. And I think we might do a double bill of John Romanello and Cassandra Forsyth, because Cass and I talked about pregnancy and training and nutrition last week. So we got that one in the bag and ready to go. So tons of cool stuff coming up for you guys, and buy some t-shirts. And that's it, I guess. Do you guys got anything else? Oh, you guys are so helpful.
Yep.
Yeah, it covers it.
All right.
Buy a t-shirt.
Buy a t-shirt. Lee, did you buy a t-shirt? Did I send you one?
No, you didn't send me a t-shirt, and you didn't send John a t-shirt either, did you?
I did send John a t-shirt.
Wow, so you didn't send me a t-shirt?
You didn't ask for one, Lee. Do you want one?
You didn't fuck...
Ah!
Did you drop
an F-bomb again, Lee?
Cut it off! It didn't even come out.
Whoa. Everybody, take a shot.
Lee.
It didn't even come out all the way, Kevin.
We're gonna end this podcast. We have to end it right now. All right, Lee, I'm gonna send you a t-shirt. All right, we'll see you. Have a great week. Pink Dumbbell Award winner. Don't give it just yet, John, because I have to quickly pull up the sound effect so we can do this all in a nice order. So I don't have to put it in post production. Who is it, John? Whoops.
It's the voicemail people, of course. Because they sent in voicemails.
Are we going to send them certificates?
Are you damn right we are.
Is that, we have a certificate that Lee Peel put together.
It's in the works. We're doing the final stages.
Of achievement. And for the Bell listeners, as one of our listeners actually suggested, and I thought that was an awesome idea, and we put our heads together, and Lee is making an awesome certificate, and awesome.
Hold on. Here's the deal, folks. I want you to, John, you got to pick one person from the phone.
No. This is my Pink Dumbbell Award, and I'm giving it to the voicemail people because they actually sent in voicemails. Next week.
Yeah, but we'll for the thing one. I want to do, it's not going to work. You got to pick one.
You can't do it.
All right, fine. I'm going to pick someone from the call-in sheet, and I'm going to say, you know what was a good question?
I have workout every day.
I don't know.
Well, we've kind of talked about milk. We've kind of talked about the Vibrams and the No Explode.
I like the milk question. I think the milk question is a good one.
Well, Lee's knowledge bomb was awesome on it.
Yeah, it brought the best out of Lee.
All right, so they both win.
Some milk and abs?
Yeah.
Okay.
All four of them win. No. Nope. You're not making me a liar on national podcast.
John, radio. You're costing me money here. All right, fine. All four yous are useses are winners. This is what you have to do. You have to first
email kevin@thefitcast.com. You have to say, hey, what up? My name is Joe Friday, and I sent in a voicemail. So I won a Pink Dumbbell Award. You're going to do that. Then Lee is going to finish up the thing for the certificate. I'm going to email that to you. You have to print it out. You have to frame it. You have to put it on your wall.
And you have to take a picture next to it. After that, I will send you a free t-shirt. And you can get a frame for a dollar at Walmart.
Can we just have some more requests here? How about they have to take a picture while doing like some jumping jacks next?
No, you have to go to Universal Studios in Orlando, Florida. You have to go on a ride that takes a picture during the scariest event of it. And you have to be holding it.
You have to be holding a shoe.
Yeah.
They have to hold a shoe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Oh. Bringing it back to that thread on Teenage.
And you have to be wearing a Back to the Future t-shirt. From Back to the Future 3, because it's the best one. And then we're going to send you a free t-shirt. And 100,000 thank yous. So
I mean, who wouldn't go after that?
All right, so is that cool? You're going to have, literally, you can get a cheap plastic frame from Walmart. I was just there yesterday. They're literally a dollar. You can get them for a dollar. You throw it up on the wall.
Supporting
you
take Walmart.
Okay, I'll just say Target, but same thing. Target has them for like $3. I'm guessing Walmart has it for a third the price. I was at Target yesterday. So I want you to pick up a cheap frame. I want you to put it up against your wall. I want you to take a picture next to it. and then I'm going to send you a free t-shirt of your size and color of choice. And I still have some of the old logos. I know some people like the old logo where it's just the dude. If you're a dude and you want just that, I can do that as well. I still got them in XLs and XXLs. So, and smalls, surprisingly. I've been smalls as well. So if you want one of those. All right, cool. We done?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, you either just heard an interview with John Brody or you're going to hear it right now. I think you're going to hear it right now. Here's an interview with John Brody. Check it out. And after that, we'll have the off topic. Hope you guys have a great week. Thanks, as always, for listening. We appreciate it so, so much. And Lee, can I sleep over tonight?
Yes.
All right. I'll see you later. With me right now is Dr. John Berardi. He is the author of Gourmet Nutrition, The Metabolism Advantage, and the co-author of Scrawny to Brawny. He's also authored Precision Nutrition. Precision Nutrition will also be offering a certification to teach fitness professionals, personal trainers, strength coaches, therapists, nutritionists, an exceptional nutrition coaching system, one that can transform the bodies of their clients in the shortest time possible. And something I'm very excited about, John and I were just talking about a couple minutes ago, because it might be something we'll be looking at down the line at Boyle's. But John, as always, huge pleasure to get you back on the show.
Yep. Well, it's always a pleasure coming back. Like I said earlier, you know, keep inviting me because I'll keep coming, because, you know, we've been doing these things for 4 years-ish now. And, you know, even before my business and my clientele started to grow, you know, we were doing Fitcast together. So happy to be back, and, you know, hopefully we can continue to share some great information.
Yeah, we talking a little bit before, episode 5 was the first time that we had you on, and this is episode 179.
That's amazing. That's good, man. I know you've been like slugging away at this podcast for forever now, and continually doing a good job and always getting better. So kudos to you, man.
The thing we were also talking about a little bit earlier is what you guys going on at Precision Nutrition, especially with the certification and what's been going on at the website. Can you start just talking a little bit about that, because we're going to be mentioning it throughout the show, and I just want to kind of give people an idea of what that's all about.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we've had a couple of major things going on, and so for people who kind of follow along with Precision Nutrition, they probably know what's, you know, some of the things we've been doing. For those of the folks who know of us but haven't been following along, I mean, we've radically revolutionized our business in the last little while. You know, when I say that, it sounds very business-like, but really, I mean, what we've been doing is changing the way we do a lot of things so that we can help a lot more people. And, I mean, we've launched 2 coaching programs, which are, quite frankly, one of a kind. I mean, you're not going to find anything like this anywhere else in the world. I mean, right now, our lean eating coaching, which some of you may have heard of, is basically the world's largest body transformation project. In the last 3 years, 5,000 clients have successfully completed the program.
Wow.
So, I mean, we're working with a lot of people. And the results are amazing. I mean, I feel like now I'm bragging about one of my kids in a different way, because leaning coaching is one of my kids for sure, and all the clients feel that way for me. You know, we track everything in this program. So every day people get a habit, and they get a workout, and they get a lesson or assignment, and we track everything. We track when they log into the site. We track, you know, what percentage of the time they do their habits and their assignments. We track their body composition, everything. And it's all through this online platform that we built. You know, we have full-time programmers doing this stuff. And one of the stats that I'm most proud of is our compliance numbers. So when we tally up all the potential exercise habits one could do, all the potential nutrition habits, and all the potential assignments, and we look at what percent of the time the people in the 6-month program are doing it, it's 70% of the time. So 70% of the time people are doing exactly what we ask them to do. And that's why the program is working so well. Now, you know, to put what that 70% number into perspective, because some people could think that's great. Some people could think that's awful. Like, well, why aren't they doing it 100%? So to put it into perspective, actually a good friend of mine works in the pharmaceutical industry, and I asked him to send me some data on prescription medication compliance. I wanted to know, like, people who are prescribed heart disease medications or cancer medications, what percent of the time they take it. Any guesses, Kev?
It's 50%.
50% is right. It's between 35 and 55%.
Do I win anything, John?
No, you win nothing at all. Well, you can use this line though when working with your clients, because the truth is, like, everyone thinks, you know, we say this in the exercise world all the time, people are looking for the magic pill. Well, they're actually not, because if they were given the pill, they'd only take it 35 to 55% of the time. You know, and that's boggling. That boggles my mind, though. That's that, doesn't it? You have cancer, you're given a medication, or you have heart disease, and you're given a medication that can actually extend your life and improve your quality of life, and you only take it half the time or less.
Yeah, that's
mind-boggling. So to me, if taking a pill is so hard that you can only take it half the time, doing like daily exercise, nutrition habits, and assignments 70% of the time is actually fantastic. So that's one of the stats I'm most proud of. And the other one is actually average fat loss during the program. The average fat loss over these 5,000 clients is 15 pounds in the 6 months. And top performers are losing up to 60 pounds of fat in 6 months. And, you know, I mean, that's great if you're trying to crash diet. But we're not doing crash diets. I mean, we're doing lifestyle habits. It's, I mean, again, talk to anyone who's completed the program and they'll tell you this is unlike anything out there. And, you know, again, another comparison, this is another stat for you to throw out, Kev. I did some research on exercise training and its impact on fat loss. And there was a study published in 1998 looking at over 25 years, 700 exercise studies. So with a meta-analysis, they basically, you know, summate all the data from, you know, 25 years, 700 studies, and they do another analysis as if it was one big study. And the average fat loss during a six-month program with doing an exercise alone type intervention, so it might be like, you know, working with a personal trainer for 6 months, is 4.5 pounds of fat. That's the average fat loss for 6 months. Now, you know, that doesn't seem that good, especially considering that it could cost about $1,000 to $2,000 a month to train with a trainer that often.
Yeah, easy.
Yeah, so it's, you know, you're looking at a couple $100 per pound of fat lost. Or no, it's actually less. It's like something like $1,200 per pound of fat loss under just exercise alone conditions. And with what we're doing with the exercise and nutrition habits, et cetera, we're losing, you know, on average 15 pounds, but up to 60 in 6 months. So even at that 15 pound number, it only costs, you know, something like $50 a pound or something versus exercise alone. So it very powerfully proves the notion that, you know, I've been talking about for the last couple of years, which is exercise alone just doesn't work all that well. And you know, often trainers kind of get pissed at me when I say this, but I mean, I can show them the data. That's easy to find. 2 seconds in a Google, like a Google Scholar search will get you that data. But I mean, we just have to start to embrace it. Both exercisers and trainers have to start to understand, look, you know, exercise alone just isn't getting it done. You need a nutrition intervention as well. And if you get it right, you can really see some great results. So, you know, I mean, that's beyond the scope of lean eating a little, but with lean eating, we're actually, you know, we're actually putting that to the test. We're actually showing that with exercise, nutrition, and some lifestyle interventions, you can see, you know, 3 to 5 times as many results at, you know, 10 times less the cost. So I'm super proud of the program, obviously. And you know, it's cool because it's not only based on what works. The program's continually undergoing this evolutionary pressure to get better, if you will. You know, the stuff that isn't working with each cohort gets, you know, it goes extinct, and then the stuff that does work remains. So we end up getting this better and better program each time. And there's just so much data, you know, 5,000 clients in 3 years at the rate we're going, we'll have, you know, 10,000 over the next two. And, that's a lot of people, you know, that's a lot of experimentation on what works. And actually there's a question coming up, I think a little bit later in the call about, you know, what are the successful lessons or the keys to body transformation? And to me, it's what we're learning in lean eating. So we can talk about that a little later. And then, I mean, we have a parallel kind of a brother program to the lean eating coaching, which is Scrawny to Brawny coaching, which is the same exact thing. It's the same exact model, but it's for, you know, skinny guys who want to build muscles versus in lean eating, where it's for people who want to lose body fat. And it's the same thing, daily workouts, habits, regular lessons and assignments. So, it, you know, and I think the real key to making it all work is that it's all delivered at a pace that's manageable for humans to actually follow. Mm-hmm. you know, you see it all over the place. I mean, you see it as a coach. People, when they're trying to change, they go about it all wrong. They try and change too much too fast. You know, they're like, okay, I need to get in shape. So I need to change my food. I need to change my exercise. I need to change my habits, everything. And, you know, they just, their chance of succeeding is not significantly different than zero. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a great book called The Power of Less. And in that book, the author talks about how when we do only one habit at a time, we have probably about an 85% chance of success. When it's two, it drops down to about 35. And when it's three, it's really not any different than zero. And, you know, I think some people maybe get it, others don't. But one of the most telling stories about how hard it is for people to adopt this idea comes from our last lean eating cohort. And there was a guy in the program who had tried to lose weight, you know, dozens of times unsuccessfully. And when he was going through lean eating, he kept complaining about this one habit at a time format. He's like, man, I really want to learn more than this. You know, this is bullshit. I need to know more. Like, you know, this one, he just was getting super impatient. Well, sort of the punchline of this story is that at the end of 6 months, the guy lost 60 pounds of fat and won our $10,000 prize for wow. The best transformation, you know? And at the end, he apologized, you know, for kind of being a nuisance throughout the program. But even while he was on pace to lose the 60 pounds, he wasn't comfortable with the idea that one habit at a time was the way to do it. He thought it was too slow. He thought it wouldn't work. And this is a guy who tried many times, you know, his own way and just couldn't get it done. So it psychologically, it's very tough to embrace this idea. But every time we run the coaching cohort, we hear the same thing. This isn't enough. I need to know more than take fish oil for the next 2 weeks. And, you know, by the end, these people have these dramatic transformations and they're like, holy crap, I finally get it. I can only do one thing at a time, you know, so it's pretty interesting. You know, it's just these bite-sized chunks proven to work. And, you know, that's how people get it done. That's the most powerful lesson with any change in life. You know, bite-sized chunks proven to work. Another way of saying it is do something every day, but not too much, mm-hmm. You know. So that's some of the cool stuff that's going on. And then obviously you mentioned the PN cert, which this one's definitely something that I'm really proud of. It's 3 years in the making, and it's something I wanted to do since I got started in this field. Heck, it's something that I wish that I had when I got started in the field, you know, mm-hmm. where I could have had an understanding of how important nutrition was to the process. But even if I understood that, which I think I did at the beginning, maybe somewhere subconsciously, but I had no idea how to do it. And that, there's this huge gap, you know, let's face it, a lot of people get into personal training or strength coaching because they're into working out, right? I mean, that's how they get into it. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening, though, is that, you know, by the time you get to do the coaching aspect of it or the personal training aspect of it, you know, the habits, hopefully, and the good ones have been so ingrained that you forget what it's like to be a beginner. You know, you forget what it took to get you up to the speed where you could eat lean protein with each meal and eat lots of fruits and veggies and, you know, follow a meal plan. And that didn't happen overnight. I mean, I remember when I first got started, you know, I, you know, kind of pissed around for the first few years of my training experience. And, you know, I goofed around with my lifting, and then the nutrition, you know, took a little while to figure out. And I was 16, 17, 18, 19, until I really started to get at least a halfway decent job at it. So that's like 4 years it took me. But when we're training our clients, we expect that they're going to get to the same level we did in like, you know, 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then when they haven't gotten there, we blame it on them, their lack of success with our, well, you know, my program's great, but the client just won't follow my advice. I mean, I talk about nutrition all the time, but they just won't listen. And, you know, it's kind of bullshit, man. It really is, because as trainers, if your clients aren't listening, you have to say something different that they will listen to, you know. And so with our PN cert, we've, you know, actually written a whole book. You know, this is a 600-page textbook that's actually based on a university or a master's level course that I teach, that's both the science of sport and exercise nutrition and the practice, which I think has been missing. So the second unit is all about the practice of sport and exercise nutrition. What do you do to get ready for a client? What are the questionnaires and assessments that you give them when they first come in? What You know, what do you do during that first meeting with them? What do you do after the first meeting? How do you determine their level, the client level, so what their prescription should be? After that, how do you set goals with them? And how do you do follow-ups? And what should your lessons be? And all that kind of stuff, we sort of outline it very clearly. And, you know, this isn't stuff I just made up. And it's not stuff that I'm like, oh, well, you know, because I was a trainer for years. It's not stuff that, in my experience, this is stuff that's based on what actually works. And, you know, it's based on what we're doing with lean eating coaching. And we've run enough people through at this point to say that, hey, this stuff is what works, you know. So, you know, people who are interested, you know, like people ask me all the time with the cert, like, oh, so what, you know, what national bodies recognize your program or whatever? And I tell them very plainly, none. We're not a nutrition certification company. We are a nutrition company, and I think we're one of the best, and I think we get some of the best results out there. So if people want to learn how we do things, then they can come take our cert, and we'll teach them exactly how we do it. And so it's not only the cert materials, but we have an online portal for people. So we've got online video lectures, one that corresponds with each chapter. We've got discussion forums for people to share ideas, fitness professionals. And then we have the exam online as well. So it's actually an awesome way to do it. And the response has been amazing. So for any fitness pros out there, this is definitely something they want to check out if they do believe that PN, you know, knows what we're doing with respect to nutrition.
Let's talk a little bit. You mentioned personal trainers and getting questions from clients.
Yeah.
One of the questions that we had from Ben was, as a personal trainer, I get several emails every day, and I'm approached several times each month about selling my clients something called, quote, structured water. Which is some kind of special secret, quote, energy. Have you heard of it? And what is your opinion of it?
Structured water. There's probably a lot of jokes we could make on that, but let's leave that for now and answer the question. Yeah, I've definitely heard of structured water. There's been many iterations of chemically enhanced or chemically altered waters over the years. I mean, this stuff actually dates back to the, you know, nowadays we use the term snake oil to mean, you know, any kind of bogus formula that makes pseudo or unscientific claims. But actually, structured water type things actually go back to the days when snake oil actually existed, you know, when snake oil wasn't a metaphor, you know, when it was actually something people were trying to sell. And so this stuff has been around for a very long time. And the truth is, I mean, there's not a lot of scientific support for some of these structured water claims that they're making, or the secret energy or the alkalinization of water so that it's much more alkaline than normal water, stuff like that. So, I mean, you know, putting my science hat on, I have to say that there's just not like anything to support it, you know, so you can't really give it too much credence from that perspective, you know, and the way that the question's framed is that, you know, these people come in and try and sell the clients this water. It's usually part of these multi-level marketing or I know that's sort of a naughty word nowadays, so people have made up other words for it, but it's basically where, you know, one person gets a percentage of each water sale that, you know, is downstream from them. So this is what you see it with all these kind of high antioxidant juices and stuff like that. They start to spread like wildfire because people are very financially vested in their sale, right? So, I mean, the water's probably no better than or no worse than tap water. So it's probably not going to hurt you. It's just probably not going to help you, and it's way more expensive. So, you know, I get how some people are so vehemently in favor of it. It's because they're making money off it. You know what I mean? They're just doing their best to do high pressure sales. So, you know, from my perspective, I don't really like the idea of structured water per se. You know, who knows? I could be wrong. In 10 or 20 or 50 years, they might come up with some way of quote unquote structuring water so that it actually has some real tangible human benefit. But for now, there's no support of that. So, you know, I prefer to kind of tell the structured water people to you know, go sell their water somewhere else. That's for sure.
Let's go into a question that we got from Sarah, and bear with me. It's kind of a lengthy question, but she gave us plenty of details. She said, She says she has a question about caloric intake. I haven't tested body fat lately since I'm not sure how to get an accurate read, but I'm 5'9", 135 pounds. I spent my life as at about the same weight, and I've always looked thin, but I was definitely low on muscle until last year or so when I started lifting consistently. My diet is high in protein and healthy fats, and I limit non-veggie carbs to breakfast and post-workout. I am trying to steadily change my body composition to get leaner and stronger without building much muscle mass. I lift 3 to 4 times per week and try to do cardio 2 to 3 times per week. Lately, I've been trying to just listen to my body and eat whenever I feel hungry rather than counting calories, but I am someone who feels starved after just 2 hours without food, so I end up eating fairly consistently, especially on lifting days. My coworkers think I'm insane. Do you think this strategy of just eating whenever I feel like I need food is a bad idea? I'm loving the freedom of not counting calories, but I do want to continue to make progress. Thanks so much.
Cool. Yeah, Sarah. I mean, it's a lengthy question for sure. She just wants to give us a lot of detail to provide a good answer. And basically, if I'm reading this right, you know, Sarah is basically asking if it's okay to not count calories and simply to eat according to her hunger cues. I mean, is that kind of what you think we're getting out of the question, Kev?
Definitely, yeah. That's the feeling I'm getting.
Yeah. If that's the case, if that's what you're asking, Sarah, and you're listening in, my answer is hell yeah. It's totally okay. Now, I know there's a lot of debate in the fitness world about whether we should count calories to get lean and fit or whether we should just eat intuitively. But this debate to me is really a silly one because it presupposes that we can't do both. You know, when we say, oh, one group gets behind counting calories and the other gets behind eating intuitively and, you know, never the two shall meet. It's just silly because, I mean, the two can meet, actually. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't prevent them from meeting. And, you know, I think in the long run, it's actually necessary to do both, to balance this idea of calorie awareness. You might not have to obsessively count calories, but to be calorie aware and use hunger and fullness signals to determine your meals. Now, you know, I know maybe this goes a little bit beyond the scope of Sarah's question, but, you know, I'd like you to permit me a little tangent here that's
Absolutely.
Related. I think the debate actually comes from two different types of thinkers, logical thinkers versus emotional thinkers. Now, you see, like calorie counting, that's very left brain logical thinking. You know, it's and for the logical brain, it's immediately gratifying to know both how many calories we're expending and how many we're taking in. Now, I say no loosely because there's a huge margin of error, up to about 20% when we try and count calories. So even if you're routinely plugging into Fit Day, you know, and monitoring your exercise activities and estimating how much you're burning, you could be off by about 20%. So although, you know, our left brain loves to calculate and know with certainty, we really don't know with certainty. But it is gratifying to think we know, right, to do the calorie balancing equation. So that's our left brain. That's our logical brain. And it likes to know things, count things, balance them out. So we know when we've done our best to meet our energy balance goals for the day, and that logical side feels gratified. So I totally get that. On the other hand, hunger and fullness are feelings that register with our right brain, with our emotional brain. When we stop eating because we feel satisfied, it makes sense to our emotional brain. And since most of us and our eating behaviors and our relationship with food is emotionally driven, it's important that our food choices resonate with the emotional brain too. So, you know, I don't know, different people like to fancy themselves logical or emotional or intuitive, right? I mean, you hear it all the time. And, you know, that's why I think we always have these debates between calorie counting and intuitive eating. You know, more logical brains say, yeah, we need to calorie count. We need to balance that out. That's the only way. And intuitive people or emotional people say, no, we just have to intuitively eat. But to me, the real secret to long-term leanness is finding that sweet spot between logical eating and emotional eating. Another way of saying it is between calorie awareness and using hunger and fullness cues to determine our intake. So, I mean, with Sarah here, I think she needs to find a happy medium. I think it's certainly okay to kind of eat when you're hungry, and if you're feeling starved, that's potentially a problem. You know, at 5'9 and 135 pounds, I can't see Sarah wanting to crash down and lose a whole bunch of weight. So for her, I mean, it's fantastic to kind of listen to hunger and fullness cues. It takes some people a while to be able to do that, though. I mean, because oftentimes our cues for hunger are not based on physiological hunger. They're often psychological. You know, we might, like you, one great example is, you know, you just ate lunch. You're walking around, like, let's say in downtown New York or Toronto or something, and you walk by a pizza shop, and they're wafting that delicious pizza smell out onto the sidewalk, and all of a sudden you feel hungry. Is that physiologic hunger? No, not if you just ate lunch and you were full. It's psychological. Mm-hmm. Another example is you had a long, stressful day, and usually eating, you know, some food, particularly carbohydrate, tends to relax you and lower your stress levels. And so you get hungry, quote unquote, and you eat. Well, again, is that physiological or psychological? You know, it depends. So, you know, for me, it takes, you know, it takes a little bit of training to figure out how to use hunger and fullness cues. So I think that's the one caveat there. We can't just tell people to eat intuitively because, let's face it, I mean, our intuition makes fools of us on many, many occasions, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think we have to, you know, do certain exercises to determine hunger and fullness. And, you know, again, I mean, like, I'm not going to continue to beat the lean eating drum, but we actually have a whole host of lessons about that where we teach people how to use that. On the other hand, we also teach the logical side, you know, calorie awareness. I don't like the idea of counting calories more than a couple days a week. You know, doing it daily can lead to an obsession just like anything else. Like checking your BlackBerry is an obsession for some people. Just you do it too much and it becomes a loop in your logical brain. And so I think, you know, it's okay to get calorie awareness. One thing I have people do when they start our program is do a food record for the first few days. And it, you know, that entails weighing out some things and measuring some things and maybe using FitDay or another program like that. And what happens, though, during that process is that you start to learn what portion sizes look like. So you realize, oh, wait, well, this a chicken breast this size, I just weighed it, it's 4 ounces. Okay, you're not going to forget that anytime soon. So you don't have to weigh and measure stuff every single day. Just doing it for like a few days or a couple weeks at the beginning of a program makes you amazingly calorie aware. And then at that point, you know, you just balance the two out. I've got awareness of my calories. I know generally how much I should be eating. And now I listen to hunger and fullness cues to determine the rest. And it's an amazingly effective way of doing it. So it sounds like that's what Sarah's doing anyway. So I'd hate to see her try and, you know, start obsessively counting calories when, you know, she seems like she's in good shape. She's listening to hunger and fullness cues, and it sounds like her diet's generally in the right direction. So kind of a long answer, but I thought it was kind of necessary to go through the process.
Absolutely. No, I think great points all around. One of the other things that are really debated in the industry right now, especially when it comes to nutrition, is fasting. And Karen has a question, Karen from New Jersey, and she asks, what are your thoughts on periodic 24-hour fasts? There's so much conflicting information out there on fasting. Will occasional 24-hour fasts cause muscle loss or slow metabolism? I've read that fasting can also give a boost of energy since the body isn't using energy for digestion. Thanks, and I look forward to your input.
Cool. It's a good question. She's right. There's a ton of, if you want to call it conflicting information. For me, I mean, I guess one of the best ways to answer this is to tell you what I do. And very specifically, periodically, I actually do a 24-hour fast. I usually do them on Sundays because Sunday's more of a chill-out day for me. And so what I'll do is I'll stop eating at, let's say, 10 p.m. on Saturday night, and I won't eat again until 10 p.m. on Sunday night. So it'll be a full 24-hour fast. And then, you know, Sunday night I'll have a small meal, something that, you know, satiates me, and then I'll go to bed, and then I'll get back to my normal plan. How often might I do this? Maybe once every couple of months, something like that. I don't have it really, really structured, but I just do it periodically when I feel like it, to be quite honest. Am I worried about muscle loss or slowing of the metabolism? No, not with an occasional 24-hour fast, not at all. Do I think it actually helps me physiologically? No, I don't think so either. I think that, you know, one fast every 2 or 3 months doesn't have enough, let's call it sort of physiological power to actually change the system in a very potent way. So I guess the question then comes up, why do I actually do it? Well, for me, it's actually kind of a psychological lesson for myself. I like doing periodic fasts to remind myself what physiological hunger feels like, and to also remind myself that I guess I should say it this way. You've probably felt this a million times, Kev, where maybe you eat every 3 hours or so, and it comes to like 2 hours and 50 minutes, and you start to feel like you really need to eat.
You're waiting for it, yeah.
Yeah, and you're sitting in your car, and you know, oh, you had some extra errands to do, and you're not going to be able to eat till maybe 3.5 or 4 hours. And you actually start to feel a little panicky. Mm-hmm. And it's not even 3 hours yet. Like, you wouldn't have eaten until another 10 minutes or so. But you start to panic, and you start to feel, like, hungry and shaky and just bad as the time goes on. And some of it, a small part, is physiological, especially if you sort of have blood sugar management issues. But one of the things is there's this powerful psychological thing when we get on the every 3 hours of eating kick that we're afraid we're going to miss a meal. Because if we do, I don't know what's going to happen. Our bodies are going to fall apart. We're going to get so hungry, the hunger will be intolerable. And I mean, I'm sure a lot of people listening in can totally identify with this. And the cool thing that you learn when you fast, when you actually make a commitment to not eating for 24 hours and you're not going to eat no matter what, is that that feeling of hunger never really get it only goes to a certain point and never gets any worse. And the first time you fast, it's like this epiphany. You go, oh my gosh, I can go for an entire day without eating and I don't feel any worse than I did at 3 hours and 15 minutes when I'm on a regular 3 hour schedule. Wow. And it's really, really eye-opening. So the next time you actually have to go 3.5 hours between meals, you don't panic anymore. And to me, that lesson is worth repeating. Another reason I like to do it is because, you know, it is actually humbling to realize that, you know, when you go on a 24-hour fast, that there are people in the world who don't eat for days at a time. And it's just, for me, a great reminder of what people elsewhere in the world are going through. And so, I mean, you know, maybe some people think that's a silly motivation, and that's okay. They're certainly entitled to. But you know what? It's my life. I do what I want, you know? So anyway, yeah, I mean, really, that's why I do it. I do it to remind myself that hunger isn't that bad. Also to just remind myself what it feels like to be physiological hunger versus, or hungry versus psychologically hungry, because you'll feel the difference on a fasting day. You really will. And then the last thing is just kind of a reminder of what other people are going through in the world. And actually, as part of lean eating, we have a 24-hour fast as a lesson. And you'd be amazed. I mean, people give us feedback on, you know, we actually ask some very specific questions about it. How powerful a lesson it is for some people to just try this every once in a while. And so, you know, that, I mean, that's my answer. You know, I don't really think there's a strong physiological reason for doing it. I really don't think it gives you a huge advantage in terms of weight control. I don't think it gives you a huge advantage in terms of weight loss. I don't think it gives you a huge advantage in terms of insulin sensitivity or any of those types of things. Some studies show that it might under very specific conditions, but generally the way most people are doing it, I don't think it gives you those advantages. But what I think it does is offer you a couple of psychological advantages, which are actually very cool. And in terms of the question here, will we lose muscle mass or lose, you know, slow our metabolism? No, we're not going to do that. But I have to reiterate again, it's not going to really change the game in terms of your weight loss or your fat loss, which is what many women think is going to happen. They think, well, okay, well, if I fast periodically, have a 24-hour fast, I'm bound to lose more weight. And the truth is, it's unlikely, because usually what we do is just eat a little more the next day to make up for it. So we end up with the same calorie balance after a few days anyway. So it doesn't really help with that. But again, I think it's actually a cool learning device.
Absolutely. You talked a little bit about hormonal response. We got a question about leptin from Jimmy. Jimmy asked, what's your opinion and position on leptin resistance? I've just recently heard of it and was hoping you could explain more.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question. It makes me wonder if Jimmy's sort of studying nutrition and exercise, or if Jimmy's, just interested because, there's some weight to lose or something like that. But, you know, for those who aren't familiar with leptin resistance, basically, we can take a step back and trace how leptin sort of this whole leptin thing was discovered. And, you know, leptin is basically a chemical, it's a hormone slash neurotransmitter that they discovered when they found there was a strain. This research group created this strain of genetically obese mice. Okay, so they had a very specific genetic makeup that led them to be obese. And these mice in particular failed to produce a chemical, this called leptin, all right, the one that we're talking about here. And so what they found is that when they injected leptin into these animals, it curbed their appetite and stimulated their metabolism to a small extent. And so it was sort of an aha moment for science, right? So these mice are obese because they're not making leptin. We give them leptin and they lose weight. How cool is that? Miracle weight loss drug, right? Unfortunately, when we did more research, we realized that overweight humans and mice, normal overweight humans and normal overweight mice, not genetically altered ones, aren't leptin deficient. In fact, the more body fat that we have, the higher the amount of leptin that we make. So it's unlike this original mouse study. We have plenty of leptin. The problem is that for people who are chronically overweight, leptin isn't doing its job. We're resistant to it. So despite the high amounts of leptin, it's not working effectively at curbing our appetite and keeping our metabolism at a certain level. So that's kind of what leptin resistance is. So, I mean, the thing is, though, you know, generally the leptin resistance type of research is looking at very overweight people. So I always hate to talk about this stuff with a generally fit crowd because I don't want them to start to think, well, oh, okay, maybe I can't lose these last 10 pounds because I'm leptin resistant, which is probably unlikely. So, you know, in terms of the science, I mean, there's some data. There's actually some data now that there are new proteins, new peptides that can actually reverse leptin resistance in very overweight people. So there might be, you know, a future where there's some drugs and some maybe even supplements that can reverse this leptin resistance. For now, though, there really isn't much. The idea is that we have to lose weight, because if we lose weight, we make less leptin. Leptin resistance we might be able to reverse by actually getting smaller and getting rid of all the fat that's producing all this leptin, and that may be one way of dealing with it. So, you know, beyond that, you know, I'm not a leptin researcher, so I'm not exactly sure what the cutting edge of this area is. And quite frankly, it probably doesn't even matter yet, because it's trickled down to fitness is going to be quite a long time. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in response to the question, you know, I mean, it's a real thing. Very overweight and very, very obese people tend to have, in fact, nearly all obese individuals are resistant to leptin. And it's just because, like any other chemical, we can become insulin resistant as well when we have too much insulin chronically in our bodies. The same thing. When one hormone is so predominant and it's always sending its signal, boom, boom, at cellular level, we tend to become resistant to it. So the idea is actually to try and reduce that signal, right? So when we're insulin resistant, we try and, you know, eat less sugary carbohydrates and less of those chronic insulin raises. And same with leptin. I mean, we want to try and lose some weight. Now, the thing is, some people think that that leptin resistance prevents us from losing fat. And I don't necessarily think that's the case. I mean, a large part of leptin's action is hunger and appetite. So although it may be more difficult because you're hungry more frequently, you know, one of the things I have always said about appetite is just because you're hungry doesn't mean you have to eat. And one of the cool sort of feedback loops is that if you lose some of the fat through sort of a more disciplined approach dealing with the hunger, sometimes our leptin resistance can actually drop anyway. So, you know, I mean, it's kind of the nickel tour of leptin and leptin resistance, and maybe a leaping off point for Jimmy to learn a little bit more.
And kind of going off the outline a little bit, another thing that's been, I don't want to even say controversial, but something that's been discussed quite a bit recently is dairy. And dairy, when it, in terms of, you know, people who tend to have more fuller fat dairy tend to be leaner. Mm-hmm. And also other thoughts in general that people should just be striking dairy out of their diet completely.
What are your thoughts on just the general topic of dairy and, you know, and just kind of, are people crazy?
Well, people are crazy universally. That's true. Sure. But with respect to dairy, I know we just had a big discussion on our member zone, our discussion community, about dairy with respect to pasteurization and all the things that are added in dairy and stuff. And, you know, when you actually look at the data, when you look at, you know, the whole big picture, okay, so, I mean, what are the potential problems with dairy? Well, you know, some people think pasteurization isn't so good and changes how the milk or the dairy product behaves in the body. Some people think that, you know, homogenization also does some damaging things to the milk. We know that certain, you know, cows are treated with certain growth hormones and stuff, and people are afraid that that's making it into the milk. We know that a large percentage of the world's population, and it's, you know, I mean, it's still, it's a substantial number of people, are lactose intolerant. We know that, you know, a noteworthy percent of the population has a mild protein allergy or a milk protein allergy. So with all the potential, you know, problems with respect to dairy, you know, one question I have is, why are people so worried about it? I mean, it's just one food. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You've got milk and, yeah, I mean, there's some off spins, you know, like, you know, you've got your cottage cheese and different cheeses and stuff like that. But, I mean, really, it's just one food. And you know, if dairy it treats you well, like if you don't have lactose intolerance and you don't get stuff, your mucousy, when you eat dairy, that's okay. You know, there still might be these issues with respect to, you know, hormones and stuff like that, although I don't think it's that huge of a deal. Then maybe it's okay in moderation. But, you know, I guess one of the major problems really is that the dairy lobby has had such a powerful effect on our dairy consumption patterns over the years, that many of us eat just a lot of dairy. You know, we just eat a lot of dairy food. And we might get into trouble if we ate that much of any other food too, any other single food, mm-hmm. you know? It's kind of like, you know, there's all this discussion of corn and how it's pervaded our food system, right? Mm-hmm. And we call it like a monoculture, right? So basically our food, you know, is so heavily dependent on corn additives and stuff like that, that it becomes a bit of a monoculture. And you know, we see it in some circles with soy as well. So to me, it's just like, we need to get away from this monoculture of dairy as well, where we just think we need to have so much dairy every day. And in moderation, if you tolerate it, fine, I'm not so worried about it, you know. But again, for me, actually, I'm lactose intolerant and I have a dairy allergy. So for me, I don't touch the stuff ever. And you know what, to be honest, I don't think it negatively impacts the quality of my life at all. So, you know, I think it's so easy to just debate a bunch of useless, meaningless stuff in the nutrition world, in the fitness world, you know. Some of us get so, you know, into this field, which is awesome. I love to see people really passionate about it, and as a hobby or as our profession. And then we just invent debates, invent things mm-hmm. to be pissed off about, invent things to nag others about, invent things to, you know, debate about, that it's really an unproductive use of our time. If one person is worried about dairy, then they should just not eat it, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, we can present a very balanced approach about what is in milk, what is in dairy. I mean, nothing is more off-putting than people sort of like walking around picket signs talking about how they put IGF-1 in our milk, you know? It's just off-putting, you know, because it's not, I mean, we don't even know that any of those hormones actually make it past the pasteurization process. And if they did, would they actually make it into our bloodstream after they went through our gut? And mm-hmm. they probably wouldn't, you know, but nevertheless, I mean, you know, it's sort of this illogical stuff that kind of turns everyone off from what could be a good message, which is maybe we don't need to drink as much milk. And, you know, it obviously, if you don't tolerate it well, it shouldn't be included. And it's just one food, you know, and the nutrients that are in milk we can get from many other foods. So that's kind of my thought on dairy. I personally don't drink any, but just because, you know, I'm lactose intolerant and have an allergy, I don't think everyone should abandon milk. But I do think people should consider their intake. And if they're very conservative, maybe avoid it. And if they're a little more risk averse, because there are some potential issues, then maybe they can have a little bit in moderation.
Very good. Fair enough. Bob has a question. He says that, I understand that you recently gave a presentation on keys to body transformation. Any chance that this will be available for purchase on DVD? What is your general advice on best practices for body transformation? And what are some of the biggest mistakes you see today in day in and day out when it comes to long-term body composition changes?
Well, there's a couple of questions embedded in here. And so I guess the first one is, yeah, I actually did a presentation on the keys to body transformation, and this is actually available. I think you can download it I actually gave it at the University of Western Ontario as part of an exercise nutrition symposium that I do every year. Mm-hmm. Dr. Peter Lemon was my advisor, so he asked me back every year. And both Lonnie Lowry, who most of the listeners are probably familiar with, and I spoke at it this year, which is cool for just like a small community event in London, Ontario. But I think our presentations are for sale, pretty cheap for like $20 or something at exercisenutritionsymposium.com. I don't get any money from that or anything like that. Actually, I think all the money actually goes to supporting the UWO women's softball team. Dr. Lemon's their coach, so he puts this event on as a fundraiser. So the women's softball team is not a university funded sport, but the girls have won the Ontario championships and I think placed top three at the Canadian national championships several years in a row. So they're very, very good, very competitive. They just have like no money, so they always do this event. So anyway, exercisenutritionsymposium.com is where you can pick up the DVD. In terms of the advice that I gave for best practices, I love the way Bob actually phrases this, because that's exactly how you have to think about it. What are the best practices? In the fitness industry, we hear people debating about a lot of things all the time. And, you know, there are a lot of different ways to get results. But the way Bob says it, I love, what are the best practices? You know, not just alternative ways, or just what are the 80 ways to do it, but what are the best ones? And I think we've been able to narrow them down through our lean eating program. You know, when you have the opportunity to work with, you know, 5,000 people where you track everything, like every alteration in girth, their photos every month, you know, their interaction with the website, their habits and their workouts, you can really arrive at best practices. And for me, there's probably 10 or 11 that I think are really, really useful. The first one is, you know, you have to do exercise plus nutrition. I mean, there's tons of studies now showing, we talked about it earlier, exercise alone doesn't work all that well, and nutrition has to be as important a part of the process as exercise. So to me, that's really critical. The next one has to do with people's, let's call it motivation. I think there has to be a carrot, a reward. You know, on the most basic level, I think people are motivated by just two things, reward and punishment. You know, and we've all seen reward examples, right? Like the bet at work is the classic one, right? Everyone throws $100 into the pot, and at the end, whoever loses the most weight gets all the money. The Biggest Loser has a powerful carrot. You know, the Body for Life program had a powerful carrot. Some people will treat themselves to a vacation or something if they reach their goal. In lead eating, we give away $40,000 in prize money, which is our pretty big carrot. So $10,000 for each of the top transformations and $5,000 for runners up for men and women. So, you know, I think the carrot is powerful. I think that in the beginning, when we're trying to decide to make a change, the carrot is absolutely essential. Some real prospect of reward gets us moving. The thing is, the carrot, the reward wears off in about 2 seconds. We need something to ensure that we're going to follow through, and that's what I call the stick or punishment. And there's this great book, I don't know if I've ever talked about it on the show, called The Blackmail Diet. And in the book, this guy John Baer was a psych professor in Michigan, and he was a yo-yo dieter for years, and he kind of finally got to the point. He said, you know what, I mean, I've been doing this forever. Maybe I should use my psych training to actually, you know, trick myself into doing this once and for all. So what he did is he created a punishment for himself, and he took $5,000 or $8,000 or something like that and put it in an escrow account with a lawyer. And he said, if I don't come back in a year having lost 70 pounds, I want you to give that money to the KKK. And for whatever reason, you know, he doesn't feel like his moral stance aligns with that of the KKK. So that was a powerful motivator for him, and he lost the pounds. And what he did then, when the lawyer said, "Here's your money back," he said, "No, keep it." The hardest part in weight loss is keeping it off. So if I don't come back a year later having maintained my weight loss, I want you to give that money to the American Nazi Party. So that was his punishment. That was his blackmail. So I think that it's pretty critical to come up with a stick, some punishment, because the reward thing always wears off. You know, the body for life, you might remember the Corvette Bill Phillips was giving out.
Oh, yes.
In lean eating, it's 10 grand. That's not chump change, you know? And at the same time, people very quickly, when things get hard, start to think, well, you know what, I wouldn't have won the money anyway, so I might as well bail. So we need to provide some kind of punishment, some kind of stick, something to say, hey, look, if you don't follow through, there's going to be a consequence. And that tends to keep people going for a little bit longer. But that only lasts so long as well. These things are like initial motivation type things. I think the next thing people need is confidence. They need confidence. Like, I mean, think about it. If you've never successfully done something before, would you be confident that you're going to rock it? Well, some people might, but very few. Most people aren't confident. So confidence, they have to borrow it from someone. And in body transformation, it's their coach that they have to borrow it from. So they need to feel confident that their coach can actually help them do what they want to do, and they need to feel confident that they can do it. So I think there's two parts of it, right? Confidence is thinking that, you know what, my coach just asked me to do something. I think I can do that. The second part is, if I do it, it's actually going to work. So there's sort of two phases to confidence. So one stat that we keep very rigorously in lean eating is the relationship between the percentage of time that people comply with our plan and their weight loss results, their fat loss results. Because I need to be confident that when people do what we say, they get the results that they're asking for. And we have this one graph that's it's almost linear graph between behaviors and results. So when you plot – you know, the different quintiles. So from when people do 0 to 20% of the habits, when people do 21 to 40% of the habits, and so on, there's a really nice curve that shows that at every interval of habit compliance, they lose more weight. And I mean, maybe some people are saying, well, big deal, but that is a big freaking deal, because now I can tell people, hey, look, people who do 90 to 100% of the habits lose 25 pounds of body fat during the program on average. People who do less than 90%, so let's say it's 70 to 90%, only lose 15 pounds on average, etc. So you can actually, I mean, it's very motivating if you think, hey, man, if I can just do 10 more percent, I'm going to lose 10 more pounds in this program. That's a great correlation. So that lends confidence, doesn't it? So that, to me, confidence is super important. The next thing is to do something every single day. And I think this is where the personal training model breaks down, because often we only see our clients 3 or 4 times a week. To me, they have to think about this process, this body transformation process, every single day. In The Power of Less, the book I talked about earlier, that's the deal, man. You have to do something every day for it to become a habit. So you need to give someone something to do every single day. You know, it might be a single nutrition habit. It might be, you know, do like a dynamic mobility sort of drill or something like that. But every single day, even in the training scenario, if they're not with you, they have to do something that's related to their body transformation. The next thing is not too much, though. It's do something every day, but not too much. It has to be one habit that someone is confident they can actually do. So we're tying back to both confidence and the every single day habit. The next is something I call active coaching. And I always describe this one as, I mean, many of us have sort of a university model that we can understand. So I remember, you know, in general, if a course is well designed, attending class will probably lead to a higher grade than not attending class. Would you agree? Probably.
Yeah.
So, you know, and there were certain classes I skipped, but in general, you know, attending class probably leads to, you know, a better grade. But how do we actually invite students to class? We just tell them when to show up.
Mm-hmm.
What if actually profs called the students? you know, and this is unrealistic in many cases, but what if you were a student in my class and I called you, and class is at 10, I called you at 9:30, and I was like, hey, Kev, listen, we're having class today. Here's what we're going to cover. I'd really love to see you there. Chances are greater that you'd actually show up, mm-hmm. and greater that you'd do better in the course. So I think active coaching is necessary. So what we do is we actually reach out to our clients every single day. Instead of asking them to come to us to get their workout, we actually send them their workout. You know, instead of asking us to asking them to come see us about their habit or for feedback, we actually reach out to them. And I think that's really critical, you know, having some form of active coaching. So if you're a trainer, important to do with your clients. And if you're a client, important to ask for from your trainer. You know, another one is accountability. We need some really, we need someone and something to be accountable to. We need to be able to check off that we're doing what we're asked to do, and we need someone to be checking that. Another thing is to emphasize behaviors over outcomes. That's another important one. You know, I think that our trainers or our coaches should be worried about the outcome, so how much weight we lose, but we need to worry about our behaviors. So we need to choose the right behaviors that lead to the right outcomes. And, you know, those are the big ones. You know, in addition, probably the last one is getting support. You know, I've often said that you're the sum of five people, of the five people you spend the most time with. And, you know, I mean, it's where you end up in life. You know, if you hang out with people who drink a lot or do a lot of drugs, you'll probably do more than you would have otherwise. On the opposite end of the coin, if you hang out with people who have a better education, or let's say go to church every weekend or do community service or real active in fitness, you'll do more of those things too. So getting support. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of a long-winded response, but those are the things I find critical. You know, doing exercise plus nutrition, having a powerful motivator or reward, having some punishment for when you don't follow through, getting some confidence somehow, doing something every day but not too much, getting active coaching, being accountable, emphasizing behaviors, and getting support. Those things to me are the key lessons. Obviously, there's some stuff you have to do with the exercise, you know, some strength training, some interval training, etc. You know, there's some stuff you have to do with proteins, carbs, and fats. But you know what? People try those things all the time and they don't succeed. And it's in these other habits that I just talked about where the success actually sticks. So that's why I talk about them all the time.
And I got to say, one of the ones that I got from you was really just, it's so, so simple. For the trainers out there, you just send an email to your clients every day in the morning and, you know, ask them how their day was yesterday. You know, were they sore from the last workout? You know, how is their nutrition? You know, just a reminder, like we have a session coming up. Just you can talk about whatever the hell you want. You can say, you know, how about that Red Sox game last night? And just it just puts it back in their mind, like, oh yeah, and I know I'm supposed to be doing this stuff today. And it's been huge.
It could be, yeah, absolutely, man. And I'm glad you've done it. You know, it doesn't even have to be an email. It could be a text message.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it doesn't even have to be personal, because some trainers are very busy. They might have 50 clients or something like that at a time, right? And for them, I mean, it doesn't even have to be a very, very individual message. I mean, it could just be a small cut and paste that's tailored, right? Mm-hmm. So it could be, hey, I was just thinking about you this morning. Looking forward to our next session and such, make sure you do X today. And you fill in X based on the habits that you have them do. You know, and literally, even with 50 clients, it could take you 1 minute per client. So you might spend 50 minutes a day. You watch your effectiveness skyrocket, your client buy-in skyrocket, their confidence skyrocket. This is just the art of coaching. And you know what? Unfortunately, in most trainers don't have any education in coaching. I mean, some of them do, and the ones that do way better than the others. But I mean, I was a personal trainer for a long time, and I know, Kev, you started out doing the same. Like, I never got a real education in any of this stuff. I don't know if you did. I don't know if you found any other places where people teach you how to coach in the personal training context, but I never did.
No, they just throw you out on the floor and say, hey, make us some money, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty much it, right? And so, you know, to me, these things are things that you learn. It's like I said earlier, it's evolution, right? You either never learn it and then, you know, you're not the fittest, so you don't survive, or you do learn it and then you know, the evolution doesn't pass you by. You get to stay, right? So
exactly.
That's I mean, it's important stuff.
And to be fair, and kind of going back to what John was saying, you know, if you think it's going to take you a lot of time, I just put all my clients into a newsletter list and I send them a newsletter every morning, and you can just do it manually. And it takes like 5 minutes to probably put together a newsletter and then just send it to everyone, and they love it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's a great suggestion. And yeah, I think it's critical. You know, with lean eating, it's great because, you know, we have this whole platform that automates the process. So, you know, it's very simple. So it uses data that the client actually fills in on their own, and then it reports back to them in that capacity. But nevertheless, they get an individualized message every morning, and it's automated. Again, you know, we use technology for that. Doesn't have to be advanced technology to do it. It can be as simple as a text message, but it's a good one.
The last question we'll wrap up on comes from Roland. He says, John, many states have rules and laws about what types of diet and nutrition advice we can give our clients. I'm interested in becoming precision nutrition certified, but I'm worried that I'll learn what to do, but then will be severely restricted in how I can use what I've learned and still keep it legal. Does your program help with this, and are other business aspects of being a nutrition coach? Do you have any general or specific guidelines that can help? I realize there are 50 states, so feel free to narrow it down to California, since it's all about me and my question. Let Michigan type its own question out. Thanks.
I love that. That's great. It's all about me and my question. Well, actually, here's the reality. There's a lot of misinformation about what we can do nutritionally in the U.S., in Canada, and the rest of the world. It's just passed on based on, you know, artificial concerns often. You know, sometimes our health clubs are worried because they don't understand what the laws are either, so they'd rather just prefer to protect their butt, which is fine. I run a business. I know my butt needs to be protected sometimes too, and just tell their trainers never to talk about nutrition. But the truth is, all over the U.S., we can actually, without being a registered dietitian, give nutrition recommendations to otherwise healthy people. That's not against the law. What is against the law is basically practicing medical nutrition therapy, MNT. And what that is, it's basically when people come into you with a disease, whether it's lifestyle related or genetic or whatever, and selling a service which promises to fix or cure or improve their disease. That is against the law. If someone were to get hurt by you coaching them in that way, it could be a problem for you. But beyond that, being a trainer, someone having clients and working with them in the fitness capacity, that person being otherwise healthy, you can certainly talk about nutrition with them. You can certainly give them recommendations and those types of things. It's not illegal, and no one's really getting in trouble for that sort of a thing. So, you know, it's just a little bit of a misunderstanding. And I know people are listening in right now, and they're saying, no, that's not what I was told. Well, again, a lot of people don't really understand the regulations. A lot of people don't really understand what they can and can't do. But to keep it really, really simple for this interview, it's don't do medical nutrition therapy. Don't promise you're going to cure someone's disease, but you can certainly make recommendations for healthy, exercising, active people. And, you know, that's the scope of practice. And in the PN cert, we actually have a whole section on your scope of practice, what you can do, what you can't do, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, and when you should reach out for some additional help. And, you know, I mean, one of the ways to sort of improve this issue, because the problem is, I mean, think about this. If every personal trainer never talked about nutrition, right? If every trainer said, no, I can't talk about nutrition, let's leave it be. How many people would actually get good nutrition advice in the world?
Good point. Good point.
You know, yeah. I mean, I'm actually doing a bit of a little bit of a search because I don't have these data readily available, but I've been looking for them the last week or so. And what I want to do is I want to compare the number of people that see a personal trainer regularly versus the number of people that see a nutritionist regularly, a registered dietitian. And I would imagine that number is insanely skewed towards personal trainers. I don't know if you would say the same, Kev. But
I'd agree. But, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It just makes sense. There's way more trainers seeing way more clients than there are nutritionists or dietitians. So what does that tell me? Well, it tells me, you know, if we'll make the assumption that every dietitian that you go to is excellent, which is a bad assumption, but let's just use it for now. Okay. So, I mean, there's loads of good ones, but mm-hmm. I mean, they're not all awesome. So, you know, we're saying that we are only allowed to talk nutrition with only that small percentage of people can actually get good nutrition advice. Well, that's BS, you know? So, I really feel like it's incumbent upon the trainers to actually learn how to talk nutrition properly, to know what their scope of practice is, to also know who to refer out to if it's beyond their scope of practice. And again, in the CERT, we actually talk about creating a network, creating a professional network where, and I know you have this and I've had it for years, where you actually have people in your network that specialize in certain areas. Mm-hmm. So you might be a trainer and strength coach, but you know a nutritionist that you can call, and you know a physician that you can call, and you know a psychologist that you can call when clients deal with any of these issues. And I mean, I'm not an expert in all of this. I mean, in fact, just today I was there's a guy, I don't know if you've had him on the show, Brian Walsh. You haven't had him yet? I recommend getting in touch with him. He's a naturopath in Maryland, and I know some people think naturopaths are wacky or whatever, but he's amazing. And I was just talking to him today about a client. So his real specialty is what we'll call abnormal physiology. So let's say I'm working with a client, and I'm doing best practices with them, and they're not really changing. And I know they're following. They're compliant. You know, what I'll do is I'll send them to Brian in Maryland, and usually he has a nice distance-based coaching practice, and he'll do a bunch of blood labs, and he'll figure out what's wrong with them, because usually at that point we know there's something physiologically off. They're doing the best practices, but they're not changing their body. And then what he'll do is he'll do an evaluation. I know what my limits are. He's amazing at that. I'm less than mediocre at that. So I send them to him at that point, you know. So you have to have a network. You have to have a professional network. So in this question, I think it was Roland that said, you can talk nutrition, absolutely, as long as it's in the right context. But I think it's really, really critical to go that second step and create an amazing professional network where if someone has an issue that a doc needs to see or a naturopath needs to see, or if they have a disordered eating situation where you can refer them to a psych person, those are the type that, I mean, that's when you get real good at your job. That's when you really have a good stable of clients, when you create a great professional network. And the other thing that's awesome about having a great professional network is the cross-referral system, mm-hmm. you know? They send their patients and clients to you. You send your patients and clients to them. All of a sudden, everyone's super busy, everyone's super happy, and everyone's getting the service and the attention that they need. So to me, that's the only way to be a fitness professional. And, you know, people haven't heard this before. I know that, or many people haven't heard this before. Some people are going to be incredulous. I mean, that's the first thing that happened when we started offering the CERT and teaching people this stuff. There's a lot of trainers who've been training for a long time who aren't doing these things, and they think I'm calling them out and saying that they suck because they don't, which isn't the case at all. I was a trainer for a very long time, you know, working in the gyms. Actually, in late high school, I was a trainer. All through university, I was a trainer, through my master's, through my PhD, and I didn't do all of this stuff. So I'm not calling anyone out and saying that they suck. But what I am saying is that all of us have room for growth and improvement. And this has been my focus, figuring out the best ways to do this. So these are things you can embrace, that you should embrace, that will make you better, will give you a better career. And this is the thing with training. I mean, let me ask you this, Kev. Do you know anyone who's been a personal trainer for 20 plus years?
No, they don't exist, I don't think.
I know one. I know one guy. He's in Toronto. He probably even listens to the FitCast. His name's Coach Mike. I'll call him by name, and he's a good friend of mine. And, you know, he's been a trainer for over 20 years, very successful in downtown Toronto. He's a guy who uses best practices. He's a guy who has tailored his life as a trainer very, very well. I mean, he gets up super early because his first client's at 6, but he has clients from 6 to 12 every day. He's like the top-ranked trainer at the chain of gyms that he works with, and so he gets a really decent wage. And you know, that's been his schedule. He structured it very, very systematically, and he's done an awesome job. And that, to me, is super rare. But there's guys like that that do exist. And, you know, I just think it's a shame that the training profession is kind of fleeting, that people kind of, like, skip in and out of it all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's because they're not doing this stuff. It really is. So, again, I hear loads of trainers kind of, when we started launching this search, saying things that, well, that's not true. You don't have to do that, whatever. Talk to me in 10 years, man. If yeah. you're still in training, then you can say you don't have to do that to at least have a business for 10 years. If you're not, then you can't say that. You know, it's I've looked at the people who've done this for a long time, you know, and this is what it takes.
Well, just wrapping up, John, again, I want to thank you so much for coming back on the show and for we got to hit on a ton of different things today. And it was,
yeah, we did.
Again, you know, it's always awesome. Huge pleasure to have you on the show. And I guess the best place, I'll throw links in the show notes, but the best cool. place to get all the info that we talked about like the certification and the coaching would probably be just going to precisionnutrition.com.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we have all that stuff. I mean, people can pop to the homepage. If they click on our products and services link, they'll be able to find all the information about all this. And they can actually, you know, folks, if you're interested in this, just come read about it. I mean, we're a pretty transparent company. Whatever we do, we put up on the site. We talk about it. We share with people. We let them see under the hood because that's the way I like doing business, and that's what I like when I do business with companies. So, you know, if any of this intrigues you, come see it for yourself. And if you're there and you think it sucks while you're there, fair enough. If you like it, we'd be happy to have you. So, yeah, that's comethepn.com.
Yeah, you owe it to yourself at least to check out the blog that they have going on there. It's something that you should be subscribed to and you should be checking out every day. There's some great stuff going on there as well.
Thanks, Kev.
All right, John. Well, again, thanks as always, and can't wait to have you on again in, you know, maybe episode like 210, 220.
Okay, I don't know what date that's going to be, but I'll put it on my calendar.
Yeah, put it on the calendar. We'll talk to you then.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me again, and thanks everyone for spending your time listening to me today.
Hello and welcome to this week's off-topic discussion for the episode of 179. I'm Kevin Larby and John Fast, Lee Peel, along with me. Here to talk about some stuff that's off-topic. We didn't have an off-topic last week. I ended up not even attaching it to the show.
Oh, yeah. Are you serious?
Yeah, I didn't even, because it was like 2 minutes and people would have, you know, been mad. So it was an interesting off topic. We'll put it that way. But I'm seeing Iron Man 2 tomorrow on IMAX with a bunch of the CP guys. It's going to be awesome.
I still haven't seen the first one. I know. I suck.
Whoa.
I know. I'm planning on watching it. It's on the list. It's on the agenda. It's on the agenda.
They have the preview for the new J.J. Abrams movie in front of the Iron Man, so might want to.
I've heard about that. I've heard about that. It's some sort of Area 51
indeed
thingy, right?
Indeed it really? Is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm out of the American loop, aren't I?
Yes, you are.
I didn't know about that. I'm very excited. Speaking of J.J. Abrams, Lost is bonkers. It's just bonkers, and
can't talk about it
in a good way. Bonkers,
yeah. It's
you can say that much. Okay, yeah. All right. So it's in a good way. Bonkers, because you know when shows end, sometimes it just goes what really?
No. Well, the very final episode hasn't happened yet, so it might still happen. But there's always been rumors that they pretty much had the entire series plotted out from day one, and there are things now that you can kind of go back to the very first season and be like, holy crap, and this was going to happen. You know what I mean? Like,
well, he did that with Alias
now.
All the way, so yeah. I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I'm going to completely disagree with you, and I'm going to say that a much better show right now is Fringe, which is just off the hook. And if you're not watching that show, you're just not doing it right. You're just not doing it right at all. You really.
That's what she said.
Sorry. John. So I'm telling you, like, it has Pacey from
Joshua Jackson
and also not Gordon Bombay, but Charlie Conway from the Mighty Ducks.
Yes.
So I really recommend you checking that show out. If you in any way like sci-fi, it's absolutely fantastic, and it's coming up to the season finale, like the last two or three episodes, and S is getting real, and it's fantastic. It's really good. It is so, so good. But yeah. My boob hurts, yeah, John.
Oh, yeah. So what happened to your boob, dude?
Oh, yeah. I read about that.
Dude, not a good situation at all.
Did you rip the tit?
I'm not kidding. We were benching yesterday, and ever since last Saturday, we were deadlifting. We were doing deadlifting clusters, and for some reason, I felt like I pulled my pec, and it was real weird because I was deadlifting, but then after deadlifting, we had pull-ups and the prowler sled push, people might have seen the video of that, but check it out, kevinlaber.com. And it was so weird because then after that we had push-ups, and I couldn't do push-ups. I couldn't go all the way down to the ground because I literally every time I was at the bottom, I was feeling that pain.
When did this happen? In deadlifts?
I swear to God, I think it happened while I was deadlifting.
Why do you think it happened then? You felt something?
That's when I first noticed it.
Okay.
It was just like discovers, like, oh, man, that felt kind of weird. And it was just kind of like, it was just sore, like, because we benched on Thursday before deadlifting on Saturday. And it was, I literally haven't seriously benched in about 3 months.
Okay.
And then I went into doing deadlifting clusters. I mean, bench clusters with the guys at CP. So
probably overdid it a little bit then.
I overdid it. And then
let me ask you something. When you deadlift, you spread the bar, or do you not pay attention to that?
We were trap bar deadlifting.
Oh, you're a trap bar? Well, you can still kind of spread the bar. It's not as...
Kind of.
Yeah. Because it is weird. I mean, I'll grant you, it's weird that the pec would be pulling on a deadlift, especially a trap bar deadlift.
Yeah, but definitely I was internally rotated, though. I mean, for the trap bars, at least a little. I mean, even though it's neutral grip, like, you're still...
Yeah.
Internally rotated. But
yeah, I guess. It's just... It's weird.
Well, anyways, from my story, benching yesterday, I still was kind of felt it. And throughout the week, I was doing, using a tennis ball, I was massaging it. I had Connor, one of the old CP interns, he did some work on me. And like the first set felt awesome. It felt good. Now, I could still feel it a little bit, but it wasn't anything major. And second set, I was feeling strong as shit. Like, I was just firing the weight up. I was like, wow, compared to last week, I'm like blowing this weight away. I'm like, what's up? And even the last set, this is a D-Lo week. They're like, oh, what should I do for my last set of clusters? Let's just bump it up. Let's bump it up 20 pounds in the last set. I'm like, all right. Because I was feeling great. I was like, wow, that last set was nothing. It was not a problem at all. So, did the first two reps. Felt good. Did the next three reps, which is like it's two reps, rest for 10 seconds, three reps, rest for 10, mm-hmm. five reps, rest for 10, then two more. So those three reps, like that last rep and the third rep, I'm like, oh, that didn't feel very good. And then on the set of five, first one went up fine. Second one, I felt a little bit worse. Third one came down on the ground, and it literally felt like my whole pec just, I could feel it not up. Like, first thing I thought was like, holy shit, I just tore the pec off. I just tore it right off. That's literally what it felt like. It felt like it rolled up, and it literally felt like muscle was tearing off of bone. I took a look at it, and that was not the case, but it feels a little bit better today than it did yesterday, but... And this is clearly, Eric's got me on a program where I will not be benching for the next couple weeks to, just to, like, lots of push-up iso holds and stuff like that. And I was just an idiot. Like, I just didn't listen to my body. I was just like, oh no, I'm going to push harder. Oh, that hurt more. Yeah. I'm going to push a little bit harder. All right. That really, really hurts. And, it's a lesson learned, and it's something that John Paloff and I have talked about before. He's like, you know what? To be honest, I see a lot of personal training clients, but the people who I see the most are strength coaches. I see people like you that push themselves hard and they never have an off season. It's always going, you know, they'll deload, but they're always like, we're always in season. And our clients are technically always in season. They never have an off season. We'll give them deload weeks, you know, every fourth week, but they're never in an off season, you know?
Mm-hmm. So. That's the biggest problem. God, where were we having this conversation? It was one of the forums we were having a conversation about, you know, ensuring, or what's the limitation to strength or something like that. And we were discussing all the variables, and periodization is huge. Mm-hmm. It's huge. Yeah. And the problem is that a lot of us, just like what you did, I mean, there's a lot of strategies for periodization, and, one of them, God, what's it called? It's basically where you listen to your body. What is a bodybuilder to do that? What's that called? Like some made up crap, you know? And they're just basically like, well, if I go in and I don't feel strong, I don't lift heavy. And if I feel strong, I lift heavy. And that's fine, kind of. But the problem is it's a really hard thing to follow gauge. All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it makes sense to a certain extent. It actually makes Stargate Universe. What?
Sorry. I don't know why that opened up.
It makes sense from – what is it? I can't remember. But it makes sense from a certain standpoint, because if you feel good, you should use that energy. And if you're supposed to be on a quote-unquote low-intensity day but you feel like a million bucks, don't you want to use that? And at the same time, if you've come in, you didn't get a lot of sleep, you didn't eat well, you feel like crap, and you're supposed to be, you know, doing a 90% one rep max – you're going to screw up your day. So there's a certain logic to it. But then again, the problem is it's like you feel great, and sometimes you go overboard because you feel mm-hmm. great. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes
people aren't always very in tune with their body too, you know, like it. And yeah. Oh yeah.
Cybernetic periodization. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've always been more of a fan of a structured, you know, periods of active and passive recovery and structured deloads. I think that I'm more of a fan of doing it even when you may feel that you don't want to.
Right.
You know, I think that, but Kevin doesn't know anything about that.
Well, I'm a jackass because I literally just jumped in and I haven't trained with those guys in a while. And I've kind of made this pact with myself to train with them twice a week. And I jumped in mid program with them and, you know, I jumped right back into doing, you know, a Crest Performance staff lift after not lifting with them for a year, like consistently. So, again, that was my fault, you know, learn from my mistakes and just, you know, again, learning to listen to your body and to not be a jackass.
Yeah.
So
you definitely tore something, because that's what a strain is. It's just a matter of how bad this tear was. So it doesn't sound like it'd be that bad.
I can go straight up overhead, you know. Abduction is not an issue, so it's feeling better. I can definitely, in terms of external rotation, I can't really do so much on that left side compared to my right side. Like if I lay down on the ground and I bring my elbows at 90 degrees and I try to do any kind of external rotation, it's just not really happening on that left side,
right.
Which, you know, is a clear sign of a little bit of an asymmetry issue going on the left side. And people have commented that my left boobie is bigger than my right boobie. So,
That was super training. MelSIP super training. That's right. Autoregulation and cybernetic periodization. That's what that was.
You know what's sad is I bought that book. I have yet to open it. I spent like $100 on it.
It's wordy.
That's what I've heard. I like to watch DVDs. That's why we do the Fick Ass. All right. Any other stuff for off-topic stuff? Lee, what have you been up to? What have you been doing?
It's been one of those crash, right? Just I'm in a bunker week. You know, it's just total bunker week. Like I've been doing the cookbook, and then I've been doing like other writing. Just a bunch of writing, an insane amount of writing.
Nice.
Nothing sexy or fun in any way, shape, or form. Hopefully that'll change soon.
No fun, you know, sexy fun parties or anything like that?
Well, yeah, but I like to keep those details of my life private.
What?
You know?
This is the Fickest.
I'm just saying, you know, like when I have my orgy parties, I don't like to invite the FitCast listeners in.
Not all of them, anyway.
No, not all of them. Although some of the really solid subscribers, I give a call.
Yeah.
Right.
The ones that leave reviews on iTunes.
Right. Especially 5 stars.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a reason why
they're my favorite.
Hey, all right.
Yeah, you don't have a follow for that, so just keep going.
No, I was gonna say, John, I can't talk about stuff, so I'm just
yeah.
John's doing stuff.
In the world is John this week. I'm going.
Yeah.
He stole a painting in Paris. And
in Paris.
Yeah, I mean. Nice. You know what? Every week I've sit here, I'm like, okay, what can I talk about on the off topic? And I can pretty much talk about nothing. And there's so much cool crap going on, and I can like basically talk about none of it.
You've been checking out that episode player on the right side of the FitCast.com, though, haven't you?
Sure. What are you talking about?
That's pretty sick, right? You go to the FitCast.com.
That's a nice plug there. Confusion plug at that.
Yeah, you can just play the episodes right on the side of the website. So when your mom wants to listen to it, she can just literally just click. It's just a click away now, John. Just a click away. All right, we're going to talk about colon cleansing. That's going to be the kind of show it's going to be this week. So I hope you enjoy it.
Oh, God, are we really?
Wow.
You're not ending it on that. Although you did make me think of colon blow.
Yeah.
No, but you know what? You can also use super colon blow.
Yes.
Wow, is there an echo in here?
What are you talking about, John?
I said colon blow, like right before super colon blow, right before you said that.
Oh, he did. He just called you out like that.
Okay, then we're gonna have to do this real quick. I'm sorry, guys, but we're gonna have to spend one more minute.
The following clip is brought to you by
Sprint. Just to play this for you guys.
Hold it. Is that what you're having for breakfast?
Sure. Haven't you heard? Fiber is really good for you.
Well, there's fiber, and then there's high fiber. Try this.
Colon blow. Sounds delicious. But is it really higher in fiber than my oat bran cereal?
Take a guess. How many bowls of your oat bran cereal would it take to equal the fiber content of one bowl of colon blow?
2.
Guess again.
3.
A little higher.
4.
Keep trying.
5.
No, you'll have to do better than that.
7?
Guess again.
8?
We'll give you one more guess.
9.
Not even close. It would take over 30,000 bowls. To eat that much oat bran, you'd have to eat 10 bowls a day every day for 8.5 years.
Wow! I think I get the picture! Colon blow must be the highest fiber cereal on the market.
Not anymore. Now that there's new super colon blow.
Super colon blow?
It would take over 2.5 million bowls of your oat bran cereal to equal the fiber content of one bowl of super colon blow.
I'm convinced.
Colon blow and you in the morning.
Colon blow and new super colon blow.
Warning, may cause abdominal distension.
That's right.
Wow. I'm going to go ahead and just put my vote in to just erase that entire end of the off topic. That's just me.
Nope, it's staying in. Hope you enjoy the show.
No, he's not.